Hello there, and welcome to RFN 264. This is Greg Ziggy, as host for Johnny tonight, who couldn't join us, as he said at the end of the last episode.
Shed the dead weight.
I am joined by my usual colleagues on the east coast of the United States, James Jones.
Hello.
And John Lindemann.
RFN back again. Check it to wreck it. Let's begin.
I rephrase that. We shed half the dead weight.
It's a process, James.
Let me fill everyone in on the episode plan here. So we will begin, as is usual, with new business with the three of us. But then in the second segment, we will not be having listener mail because it wasn't the most emails coming in yet. Obviously, we did quite a few last week and we always want more. So rfn@nintendoworldreport.com for those. But for this week, I thought, well, let's look at it. Johnny's out. It's episode 264. A few weeks ago, it was the 15th anniversary of the Nintendo 64 in the United States. So what better time to have a feature discussion on the future of the 3DS given smartphone gaming's rise, I think.
I will fucking kill you in your sleep. In your sleep.
All right, let's talk about it.
You're a much shorter flight, Lindemann. And I know where you live.
Just seems like a topic that's not been covered adequately in recent episodes that we need to get to. I kid, of course, we are going to do an N64 show. And now, this might seem like, to some of our newer listeners, some sort of completely unextraordinary thing. But in fact, there is a big backstory to this that our faithful listeners are all...
I mean, a big backstabbing in this.
that maybe all those that have gone back to previous episodes will be able to guess what's gone on here. So back in episode 89.
Wow.
So if you can believe it, there's 175 episodes ago.
Never forgive, never forget.
Shortly after the current team, the four of us, had taken over running of the show. Johnny wanted to do an N64 episode, but he didn't want to do it with us. So he was very fair. You have to say that. He was very fair because he kicked all three of us off for three different people. He didn't play favourites. And so we recorded with the founder of our website, Billy Berkhammer, a recent guest and Retronaut's favourite, Chris Kohler from Wired.com's Game Life, and Evan Birchfield. So that was the lineup.
One of these four is not like the other. Who called in sick for that one?
So that was the lineup. We were left off despite however much love we had for the N64. It didn't matter. Johnny was resolved to do it that way, and he did. And that, it's a good episode. I could certainly invite anyone.
Bear in mind that when we were told we were doing an N64 episode, we were like, yeah! And then he's like, but not with you guys. And we're like,
oh, wow. Right.
But the James back in those days, of course, was the editor before I was. And
yes.
he still had to edit it. It didn't matter that he didn't take
part. I still had to edit it, and I made sure it was the roughest edit I ever put out.
I thought, like, well, if he's going to pick one of us, this almost has to be James, doesn't it? Because, the guilt factor. That didn't matter. They still didn't get on. So that was that, and it's festered as a wound ever since. And so now, with this conjunction of factors, I thought we've got to set the record straight. We've got to put this behind us by doing our own N64 episode. Kind of like a month late for the 15th anniversary, but never mind. That the N64 was full of delay, so it's only really appropriate.
to be fair, if it was going to be really appropriate, you would then announce after new business we're not doing that segment.
Well, you could still do the smartphone gaming thing if you want. Still on the table.
I will rack up enough frequent flyer miles taking both of you out. Don't challenge me.
That's the thing, though. I think here we do have the dream team, though. I think we can all agree on that, finally.
Oh, we do. Dream team, as Vince Young would say. So we'll get to the dream team, all of the sordid history of the N64, and go through all of our favourite games and our memories of the period and all that kind of stuff. That's all coming up. But it will not be with us three alone, because we do have en route the host of Radio Trivia, Michael TYP Cole, to join us for that segment as well. So you can look forward to that, but we are going to start with new business. It should be a pretty brisk segment, actually, but James is going to kick us off, and I use that term very deliberately because he's still playing Inazuma 11.
Well, I'm not still playing Inazuma 11.
Oh, what's this Twitter series you've been running then? Is that just...
No, because I beat it already. It's over.
Ah, I see.
The game is done.
You've been playing it. So what have you gleaned from your time completing the game?
So amongst the things I've learned from Inazuma 11 is the fact that you can, quote, buy a ticket to brainwashing. Which, I'm not kidding, that was a quote from the game that I thought was particularly interesting. It was a question. I picked yes. This game is actually full of lots of... Like, either the translators were just having fun with it, or were completely out of their league with how weird the script was.
Or just trying to get the job done.
Which is also possible. So, I went from last week, I think I was still trying to get a handle on the game, up till this point where I've realized that the games are actually more like scripted events.
Right.
So there's a match where you literally can't do anything in the first half. At all. If you get through the first half and don't give up any goals, that's the best outcome you can have. Because in the first half, your opponent is literally acting like gods. And, I mean, in context of the game story, they are actually gods. They all have, like, Greek god names, and they have, like, magic powers beyond the fact that they can make their soccer ball turn into a giant dragon, which pretty much anybody who plays can do, apparently. But they can essentially steal the ball at will and prevent you from stealing it from them also at will. So if you just get through without being scored on, you've pretty much accomplished the best you can do. But then in the second half, I played them again to a 0-0, and then in the overtime, I beat them like 6-0. So it's just kind of like, how long do I have to hold on before? Oh, there we go. Game over.
So again, this is the sort of thing that maybe you'll have to play it to realize that, oh, yeah. I see, like this is not happening for the first however many minutes of the game.
About 5 minutes into the first half, which in real time is probably about a minute, it was immediately apparent that I was not going to accomplish anything in that half. And that I just had to presume, based on where the story was headed up until that point, that they were going to do something to make it so I could actually score. It was not a good feeling, let's put it that way.
So how does the game develop as it goes on in terms of your team grows in power in some way, given that it's, you know, sort of an RPG format? How does that play out in practice?
So members of your squad, and let me rephrase that, there's three squads. There is your game squad, which is... your 11 starters and 5 reserves. And then you can have additional players on your team, but you can only have those 16 slots assigned. There is your party squad, which is Mark, you know, the very Japanese name Mark.
Yeah.
And 3 of his friends. And they can, and that's the group you play those random battles I talked about last week.
Yeah, with the chess club or whatever.
Yeah. And then there is the multiplayer squad, which is another 16. It can be the same squad as your in-game squad, but for whatever reason, they gave you 2. But what happens is you get into a match, you have your 11, and then you can swap people out at game breaks. And at the end of the game, everybody's awarded experience, although because players who have been in every single match I've participated in aren't even remotely close to the same level, I presume some level of experience is awarded based on what that particular player did in that game.
Right, so achievement, like...
Yeah, but it's not real clear how it's doing that.
Right, so it's not obvious that, well, they did this many assists, or they scored this many times, so they get bonus points.
Right, because I have a character named Max, who apparently for most people who play the game isn't a particularly great forward. But for me, he works well with how I use him, which is basically he just lobs the ball back and forth with the other forward until they get shots on goal. And his level's not that high, but he scores at least 1 goal a match. Versus some random-ass defender in the back of my field who basically plays defense every so often. He's like 10 levels ahead of him. And they both played in every single match. I can't understand how this happened. But as you level up, you gain stats. These affect, apparently, it's not quite clear how sometimes, these affect like their ability to successfully complete passes, their ability to avoid opposing tackles, their ability to engage in tackles, their speed on the field. There's also the secondary methods of training specific skills that you can find around town. And what I found is that it's not real clear how you're advancing, because I had a goalkeeper in that was about level 15 when everybody else was level 30, and he was holding his own pretty well. So I'm not entirely sure that it's a huge effect. Now, individual characters do have different stats. So as the game goes on, you can recruit players from other teams you've played or from around campus, or the characters you download when you connect to the Wi-Fi connection.
Oh.
Sometimes you'll come across a character who's a really low level, but his stats are like somewhere in the neighborhood of people who are on your team, and you're like, well, I want that.
Yeah, because like, once he gets leveled up, his stats will be even better.
You bring him to one match, he picks up like six levels, and you're like, he's not any freaking better at all. Come on.
It's oddly not very transparent.
No, it's a bit weird.
So if you don't have a very kind of obvious sort of sense of progression from that, other than just numerically, like, what about the matches and the kind of like the substitutes for battles in this game? Right? Do they change in any sort of significant ways as the game goes on?
So one thing you do get from leveling up is you gain access to more special skills, but also throughout the game, you're given these like skill books that you can teach to anyone. And then you're also given event skills, which are story-driven events you have to find in part of the RPG component. For example, there's a team from, and I'm not kidding, Farm Junior High School, because shockingly, they all live on a farm. And it talks about how people in the country all know how to work and live together, so they're all really in sync, and they play this style of defense called the Infinite Wall that you can't score on. Well, you can't score on them except for the fact that in the course of the story, you found a special move that essentially is like watching Cirque du Soleil kick a ball. I mean, there's three people in the air kicking it at the same time, and then it explodes on the other side. So this infinite wall does not become very infinite once you've begun shelling it like the walls of Constantinople.
So that's some of what happens as the game goes on, is you just get more of this crazy stuff to use on teams.
Yeah, so a lot of the matches, there's a challenge at the beginning, you know. You're told before the match, well, this team specializes in this skill, and usually it's something related to their defense. And until you do it, until you do whatever the game's counter is, you're going to really struggle against them. And once you do that, it's all gone. You know, the brainwashing junior high school, which was real, that was really the name of the school, they were all brainwashed, shocking, and they were brainwashed into being better players than they actually were. So once I used the special skill on that, they weren't brainwashed anymore, and then I clobbered the living crap out of them.
Huh.
So but it really, the only trick was I had to get someone who had the right skill up to the goal. And unfortunately for me, that was somebody way in the back of my defense. I was like, oh, I have to drag your ass all the way up here, don't I?
So is that more like how you end up maybe getting stuck and then overcoming it rather than just like, oh, I'm not leveled high enough?
Pretty much. But I mean, since the game, a lot of times the game tells you, you need to use this skill. And many times they actually assign the skill to a player as part of the story, and then if you don't have him in your active roster, they get mad at you and tell you to put him in there.
Pretty guided, then.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the game was pretty clearly intended for a younger audience, and maybe it was marketed to in Western markets. Like, there's a construct called the Football Frontier Championships, which is a bunch of junior high schools from Japan who play a nationally televised football broadcast that the whole world stops to watch. It's like, no, that doesn't happen. Like, people are literally murdered in order to win this championship multiple times. I'm like, what the hell? I think the biggest perk of this game is how completely and utterly insane it is to include things that happen to you. You're poisoned. You're intentionally given bad food. The aforementioned brainwashing. Your lives are threatened. The lives of younger siblings are threatened. The lives of coaches are threatened, you're spied on, you're stolen from, and someone tries to kill you.
You know, the disturbing thing is as isolated incidents, I can actually think of real-world analogues for quite a lot of those.
With soccer, especially, right?
Well, spied on, I think you know which football I'm thinking of with that one. But happening all to the same team at the same time, probably not.
Especially at the junior high school level. It's like...
Yeah, the junior high school level, it's rare.
I mean, I thought the Americans took high school sports seriously, but they're evidently the Japanese somewhat more so.
So as I noted on Lesson 4 from Inazuma 11, quote, it's better to spy on your foes than to practice.
Spoken like a New England Patriot.
There we go.
Yeah.
But this was part of the chapter called, and I'm not kidding, this is the quote, Beware the Maid Cafe.
From the chapter called Belichick.
I pointed out that Beware the Maid Cafe is really just common sense.
So, overall, you were happy with it?
I enjoyed it. I mean, so now I'm kind of in these matches that get unlocked after you beat the game. which makes me wonder, where did these teams come from if they're not in the football frontier, but apparently they're better than everyone in it?
Is it like a Pokemon thing? Like, oh, actually, it was just this another region that we hadn't...
Oh, yeah. Those guys over there are way better than we are. You should go over there. No, but these are basically mashups from other teams. Like, every person you thought was a bastard from all the teams thrown together.
Right.
So, that's pretty much... I mean, I might goof around with it a little bit more. I might try to get down some of the replay matches, which I guess unlocks some stuff. And hidden in the game after you beat it is the opportunity to play Professor Layton's team.
Oh.
Which consists of Layton, Inspector Chemley, Flora, the villain from Diabolical Box, Luke, and Luke. A handful of other minor characters. And it's like, so if I win, do I get to get anybody from this team? Like, could I recruit Flora and then not take her on any games?
So what does Luke play, just out of curiosity?
I believe he's a midfielder.
Oh, nice.
All the major characters in this game are almost always midfielders. It's a very weird... It's actually kind of an odd conceit, because then you have all these midfielders and you're like, well, shit, I don't need this many midfielders. What am I going to do with them all?
Yeah, I was hoping he'd be in goal so you could like hit him with a flaming something.
No, Leighton's in goal, so you could just destroy him with like earthquake kicks.
Nice.
I mean, really, the game itself is dumb. I mean, it's in terms of like what the game is, it's incredibly stupid, but it's just joyfully dumb experience where you're just like, you know what, game? Just do your worst at this point. You know, I don't... Oh, you tried to kill me with steel girders. Yep, that's... Well done. Nice work.
So, before we move on, there was, of course, quite recently, the Level 5 World event. Yes. Or is it Level 5 Vision? I forget.
This is Vision.
This was their big event, skipping TGS the way they did to showcase all their titles. And I know you've been looking forward to it, so I was wondering if there was any takeaways from it that you'd like to
Not
share.
Not much. we got a new trailer for The Time Travelers, which looks an awful lot like the last trailer we saw for The Time Travelers.
But now it's going to be on PSP, 3DS, and Vita as well.
It's everywhere at this point. We got to see the Layton Wii game. I'm not Layton Wii game, sorry, the Inazuma Wii game.
Yeah, that's like a championship edition thing.
Yeah.
Because it is already, the original version is already out, and then they're updating it with stuff, I think, from the 3DS game as a sort of enhanced version coming out at the end of the year. But, I mean, the big one, I guess, for you would be Layton versus Phoenix Wright.
Right.
So people got to play it and stuff for the first time.
Yes. And unfortunately, there's been a bit of a paucity of English language hands-on impressions of it. I've seen a little bit. I'm super into where this game is going. Like, this game, I might have to call in sick for, like, a month. Because even if I beat it in a week, I'll probably want to play it again. Or three times. I'm not sure. I said this when it was first announced, and I still feel this way. It's like the ultimate wish fulfillment game for me. I went and rewatched the interviews of the producers of the game when they were talking at the event with English subtitles, thankfully. And for them, it almost reads like they were basically making this game as wish fulfillment. Like, this is what people want, so we're going to make it.
Yeah, of course, wouldn't it be cool if kind of thing.
Yeah, it was like, okay, yes, it is very cool. Thank you.
And there was some more on Fantasy Life, which of course is the project that came out of the London Life game that people will be sort of getting, at least in America.
And Australia. Take that.
Yeah, and Australia. Yeah, well, yes, it's a single language issue there.
Yep.
But it obviously looks very different now.
It does.
London Life basically looks like Mother 3 because it's developed by the same people. Brownie Brown, it looks quite a lot like it anyway. And I imagine in its original DS form, Fantasy Life would have looked similar.
It did, yes.
Yeah, but now it's, you know, 3D, you know, not just in the stereoscopic sets, but actually polygonal models and all that kind of stuff.
And it looks very good, actually. I mean, it's not like an eye-popping game, but it has a very nice aesthetic to it. I mean, I still have no clue how these games play, although I probably will by the time we start reconvene next week. Mm. But I'm interested, to say the least.
So now we'll move on. John, you haven't got very much, have you?
No, I did play a bit more Demon's Souls, things of...
I was going to ask, did you at least have time to say, thank you, sir, may I have another, to Demon's Souls?
Yes, I did. Things are getting tougher now just because the game has opened up / closed in, crushing my hopes and dreams.
/ collapsed all around you?
Yeah, because once you beat the second boss in the first area, you kind of come up to this sort of archway, and it says, well, you can't do this until you beat, I think, an arch demon.
Get it? Get it? It's a pun.
Yeah, you go back to the main area, to the hub area, and that's when you can go to all, like, the other five, I think there's five more worlds that you can go to. But the thing is, you really don't know which one you should go to next because they all seem to be difficult.
Did any of them have a signpost that says, welcome to Pompeii? Because if it did, you should probably turn around.
Yeah, no. But
get the F out.
Yeah, it feels like it after playing it for a while, but...
Damn volcano keeps erupting! Jesus!
Yeah, so I think I'm just going to pick one and keep rolling with it.
Sounds like tough sledding.
Yeah, the struggle continues.
For my new business, first of all, Arkham City came in today, so I did get to play that very, very briefly. And seems to be off to a fairly good start, but terribly, terribly early. I probably won't be able to go into much depth on it for quite a while, so I still play quite a lot of stuff, including Xenoblade, which I'm approaching a milestone on from the point of view that I've almost put enough time in there to equate to editing 2 episodes of the show. it's coming along though. Unlike Demon's Souls, it's nice and easy, and I've been enjoying it. But what I'm going to talk about this week is a game similar to James' pick in some ways, but something I've been playing sort of sparingly, but for several weeks. It's I've talked about. I've mentioned it before. It's Mario Golf Advanced Tour for the GBA, naturally. So this was the GBA Mario Golf game that came out about a year after the GameCube one. And in many ways, it's kind of like a portable facsimile of the GameCube game, but then with this whole story mode added to it, which in many ways makes it more substantial than the console version. And it functions well in that regard from the point of view that I think it teaches you how to play the game very well. You've got all these sort of optional side games where you can practice putting, driving, approach shots, all that kind of stuff. So, that would be great for someone who's not a veteran of Mario Golf like me. Obviously I was, so that wasn't like hugely entertaining in itself. But some of the more difficult challenges do mean that, you could still have some satisfaction overcoming them, and it gets you experience points. So that's the thing. You're building a character from a very low level in the beginning. And, it's funny, like, at first, the RPG sort of trappings seem like they might be quite severe, almost, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you get this quite long sort of exposition sequence in the beginning, and there's quite a lot of dialogue, and all this stuff about, this golf club, and, like, all the people that used to be champions there, and, like, you've got to work your way up and all. And then after that, there's pretty much nothing. There really isn't a story to it. I mean, the RPG-ness of it is just going around and doing things for experience and then allocating those points to different stats. You've got, like, how far you can hit the ball, how sort of wide your impact zone is your margin of error, essentially, on the timing. And that, things like spin control, all these, so the cool thing about it is that there are already, just if you looked at the GameCube game, a lot of different sort of stats for your character that you can manipulate. And so, I could kind of craft a character that suited me from when I used to play the GameCube game years ago now. So I used to play with, Bowser and stuff like that, so I was quite happy to have, a tiny impact zone and huge power. And also, I was quite happy to have the trajectory deviate a lot, because you can kind of straighten it out by changing your impact point. And so you can kind of have the benefit of having a straight shot with that while still being able to, smack the ball really far and all that kind of thing. So it allows you to customize the character quite deeply in that sense.
Now, this was done by Camelot, right?
Yep. It was, yeah. So Camelot had already done, they'd basically doing the same trick on the GameCube and GBA that they had done on the N64 and the Game Boy Color.
Connectivity! No, wait.
I played the N64 Golf, but not the Game Boy Color one. So it's the first time I've done this sort of portably. And, I mean, there's some drawbacks to it, most notably the fact that obviously you're trying to represent, a three-dimensional golf course with all the hazards of the landscape, but in two-dimensional graphics.
Yeah.
So there's a few times where it's like, am I going to hit that tree? Am I going to get over that ridge? I mean, they've got, it's quite remarkably close, but at the same time, because you haven't got a full 3D environment, you can put the camera anywhere and all that, you will find it's more difficult to read things in that sense. So it's a bit limited in that way. But on the other hand, you have got this whole customization RPG element that kind of offsets it. And of course, what you can do with the GameCube and the GBA is hook up the connectivity cable to put your character from the GBA game into the GameCube game, which I've actually done because I've still got all the stuff to do that.
Nice.
So that's been cool. I've racked up about 10 hours of gameplay now, so I've completed most of the main courses. Like, I mean, it's got a very similar kind of difficulty curve to the GameCube one, even though the courses are different in the sense that you get quite a few gentle courses and then like the last course is completely mental. Like in this case it's a Lynx course, so you've got crazy winds, you've got loads of hazards, you're thick rough, all that kind of stuff. In the GameCube's case you had the Bowser Castle, which was many magnitudes more difficult than like the first four courses. So it's kind of similar in that way. I do wish they would sort of make it more even and have fewer courses that are a bit unremarkable. But it's been fun. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I think golf anyway, I'm not so sure about tennis necessarily, but the golf lends itself really well to this format. And you know, obviously they are bringing back the tennis for 3DS, but I would be very happy if they could do it for golf as well at some point, because it really would benefit from being able to have the 3D graphics and everything just more from the polygonal sense rather than stereoscopic, but that would be good too.
It's like your golf ball goes into the screen.
Yeah, or they probably have like the replays where like the ball's like going into the cup.
It's coming to face.
Yeah, exactly. With like the crazy lightning trails or whatever, like when you get in the Mario Golf game, so... No, it is good. I mean, the only problem is TYP, who'll be joining us later on, as I said earlier, did review the game originally, and his complaints really were about sort of like the graphics and some of the trappings of the Golden Sun Golf, as James has sort of referred to it before.
Yeah.
Because it is Camelot. It's so, apparently it's really similar with like the emoticons and the dialogue.
Oh, they
and
stole
all.
The graphics engine.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're just like, oh my god, this is Golden Sun.
It's the same technical foundation, and I think in the case of handling the actual golf courses, I'm not sure it was necessarily the best one, as TYP mentions in his review. It still works, but there's also a bit of a disconnect between the town sort of areas, you know, the actual sort of golf clubs themselves. So, you know, where you're kind of hanging around in the clubhouse or talking to people and stuff. They look quite nice. They look a bit like Mario Luigi-ish. But then the actual golf courses, when you're on them, have this sort of smeary, pre-rendered look that's not as attractive. Maybe some of that is trying to ape the console games a bit more closely, but obviously with the GBA, it's not really fit for that purpose.
I miss the era of the GBA where they could have multiple distinct graphic styles just for hardware reasons.
But I tell you, the music is pretty much like, but it's exactly the same.
Well, that's more a credit to the N64 than the GBA.
No, it's the same as the GameCube. I mean, it sounds just like the GameCube game, and it's got the voices, you know, like the announcer, like nice shot, and like, I mean, it's so authentic. You know, it really is like me going back to the GameCube game, but just doing it portably in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see this come to 3DS. I mean, I think it'd be really good, you know, if like playing on the train or whatever, just play through an entire course or maybe half a course and, you know, save your game on the ninth hole or something. Or
yeah, I mean, with this, you've got quick save, you could do anything, even though it was obviously GBA, so it wasn't the DS era of just, you flip it shut and you're good. But the quick saves and the sleep functions and all that, you could still do manually. Yeah. So, I mean, there's no problem with that. And the other cool thing is they do have like a certain amount of things where you could get goodies for just poking around in the environment. So, like in each different golf club area, the sort of the practice range of them, there'll be some sort of Mario enemy character hidden in the environment. And if you get like a blooper or something like that, and if you can find it and sort of like hit it with your golf ball, essentially it's like, all right, do you want to practice here? And then it's like, all right, they'll just beam it in the head with my golf ball. Then you'll get a ticket, which then lets you go to like the guy that makes the golf clubs, and he'll make you like a special set.
Yeah.
So you can actually mix and match then what kind of golf clubs you have in your bag. So you could have like super powered woods, but then on the other hand, automatic backspin on your irons to help hold your approach shots on the green and stuff like that. So it adds even more sort of depth to the customization of your character, essentially, this is sort of independent of your character stats. But at the same time, actually does get you doing some more sort of RPG stuff, I guess, in terms of just sort of poking around and talking to people and investigating the environment a little bit. So I've been really happy with this. It's funny, I mean, why I didn't pick it up all those years ago is a little strange. I think a lot of it just has to do with it was kind of pre-DS, and I was not in the habit of playing portable games nearly as much back then. So it just didn't appeal to me in the same way of having a sort of easy access version of this game I really like on the GameCube.
Yeah, I mean, I could see them doing some really cool stuff with Street Pass on 3DS, where you could maybe like have a trick shot or something that you could challenge people with. So they could, like, download your trick shot and then do it? Something similar to what you were talking about?
Well,
there.
Also, like, replays. One thing I always loved about the Mario Golf games, I had 64 and the GameCube one, is, like, with the way it would save your replays, because sometimes you could just have some absolutely mental stuff. I remember, like, well, I think it might have been the first or second day I had the N64 golf game. I had a hole-in-one off a terrible shot. Like, you can see that you see the replay and it shows the meter still, you know? And you can see I miss the middle by like half a mile. And then it goes flying off and then like hits this ridge in the green, bounces off it, and then like backspins straight into the cup.
It's magic!
Stuff like that is just, you know, you never forget. If you could share that with your friends and all that kind of stuff, it'd be great. So, I mean, I'm a big video game golf guy of all sorts, you know, the wacky kind, like, or like this, or the more sim stuff with Tiger or whatever, like, but I'd be quite happy for more personally.
You're gonna love Inazuma Golf.
That's kind of seems like kind of thing level 5, you know, because
the golfers are using magic. Damn it, no wonder I can't win.
So that's going to end it for New Business. And so the much anticipated 175 episodes in the making N64 anniversary segment is coming up.
Of revenge.
After this break.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with more impressions of Super Mario 3D Land, this time by Dan Koopman, who's in fact got to play the entire game from start to finish. He's completed it, so you can read at least his thoughts on the first part of what he played that's not embargoed.
Yes.
And there'll be more to come in the coming days. And then also, you've got more of your top Nintendo first-party holiday games with Kirby's Return to Dream Land impressions by Neil Ronahan. So he's got to play the final build. In this case, we've got impressions extending to the first 5 worlds of the game.
We also have a review of Dragon Quest Monsters Joker 2 for the DS from Matthew Blunden, which he says, you can explore a mysterious island and collect over 300 monsters in a decent Dragon Quest spin-off. We also have a review of Tetris Axis for the 3DS from Zach Miller, which he notes is filled with variety that is actually unwelcome.
That is not a frequent criticism.
This has got a lot of variety. Damn it.
But perhaps in Tetris, I can see where the frippery might be objectionable.
Keep it simple, stupid. That's what I always say when it comes to Tetris. All right. On the review front, we have a review by our own James Jones, Salato Robo, Red the Hunter. And much like James Jones' life, he says it starts with moving crates and ends with saving the world.
It's James from birth, a prodigious crate moves. It's much like Anakin and pod racing, but with crates.
Everyone stand back. That crate is getting moved.
And we also have a video interview by Jared Rosenberg and Josh Max of Ryan McDougall on Resident Evil Revelations. An interview in which NWR finds out all about the next entry in the Resident Evil series at New York Comic Con.
Something else that's an interview is an interview with Jake Kaufman by Nate Andrews. This is a text one, unlike the video one, but it's still very, very interesting. So we talk with composer known as Vert, Jake Kaufman, about his music, his inspirations, and indeed neoclassical wank metal.
Sounds like John's Sunday night.
If you've ever enjoyed the music in a way forward developed game, there's a pretty good chance that Jake composed it for it. So check it out. It's pretty wide-ranging, extensive, very interesting. And we have very much more such excellent original content coming up all the time, as well as the latest news, over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. This is part two where we discuss the N64's 15th anniversary and our own self-gratification.
Revenge!
But joining us to break up the self-indulgence and whatnot a little bit is the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, Michael TYP Cole.
Hello, everyone. I'm here to keep tabs on these guys.
To revenge!
It's not let our pent-up frustrations overwhelm us. We're here to celebrate the N64's 15th anniversary. Of course, we did the Super Nintendo 20th anniversary stuff between the live show at the end of last year and the SNES 20 discussion that we had a few episodes ago here. And I can assure you that later on in the year, we will be addressing both on the podcast and on NintendoWorldReport.com the 10th anniversary of the GameCube, of course, very inextricably linked with the history of our site. So that'll be getting covered too. But for the N64, we wanted to take this opportunity to celebrate it too. So first of all, we're going to take a little look at its history, because I think it's pretty extraordinary. I think the further away I get from it, the more I realise just how completely mad it was. Mm-hmm. And certainly very, very different from what we've become accustomed to with the way Nintendo handles hardware unveilings and, you know, pre-release hype and all that now.
Yeah, I very much agree, Greg, because to be honest, I didn't really follow the N64 before it came out, so I didn't really know all the crazy stuff that went on. You know, I read about it after the fact, and I was like, really? I mean, this is some pretty crazy shit that happened, you know?
Well, that's the thing. For me, I really lived through that. I mean, if you know what I mean, like, I could confidently say that I will never be as excited for a platform or as hyped up for a platform again as I was for the N64. It was just the perfect intersection of being sort of old enough to appreciate some of these things, you know, and have the knowledge of games that are accumulated through the Super Nintendo era, but yet also young enough to get ridiculously excited and not just be sort of mellowed out and jaded as you do when you get older. So, you know, it was that perfect point of like where I was obsessed. I had the magazines every month. I was always looking for more information. Towards the end, you know, I could find a certain amount out on the internet, but that was pretty limited, I can tell you, with the dial-up speeds back then. 28k.
Oh yeah.
Those Killer Instinct screenshots took a long time to turn up, I can tell you that.
I remember watching those just going, oh wow, this is really awesome, half a screenshot.
Yep. So James, where were you with the excitement for N64? How did you get into it? Or
so, bearing in mind that I had missed most of the SNES generation.
Yeah, you were 2 years younger than me, so I mean, I was pretty young during the Super Nintendo. I was certainly too young to appreciate how exciting it was quite at the beginning. I mean, it was exciting, as I've said before. It's like, oh, this new import system and all that, but I didn't appreciate the way I did with the N64.
Right. I had made a lot of my gaming home on the PC through that age time because they didn't, by they being my parental figures, did not purchase a video game console for me. Ever, now that I think about it, until the N64. The NES I got as a gift from someone else, but the PC they had to have in the house. So I sort of backdoored into being able to play video games. But I played the SNES a lot at my cousin's house because he had it and he had what might be the most bizarre collection of games anyone has ever amassed for that system. So I was aware of what was going on and I was very much plugged into the internet from pretty much like the very beginning of it being a consumer product. So I was following the coverage on all three of the systems launching. I remember distinctly reading about the Saturn launch a bit after it happened, going, well, that was just stupid.
Oh, I think we might touch on that a bit later on, but in many ways, it's kind of like another podcast. It's not one that we would make, but
no, I mentioned that especially because it sort of gives kind of like an interesting perspective on how naive the industry was at that time.
I think that is a very appropriate word. A lot of what we're going to talk about in the first part of this discussion, the sort of prologue to our discussion of the games, which is really what we want to focus on, but it just to give you an idea of what the industry was like for observers at the time. And
it was insane.
Yeah, companies were just throwing everything at the wall and seeing what stuck.
So, John, I won't commit to how many years older that you are than me.
thousand.
You were the oldest among us, so were you kind of not getting pulled in?
Oh, no,
to
I
this
was,
process?
No, I was completely sucked in because, I mean, I had just come off. I mean, I had been playing the SNES up to that point, you know, playing all these amazing titles like, you know, Super Metroid and Super Mario RPG. So I was, you know, completely just Nintendo, Nintendo, Nintendo all the way. So I was looking forward to the N64, huge. I mean, just the fact that at that point that was kind of like 3D was completely new. I mean, there had really only been 3D-ish games done on the PC up to that point, like stuff like Doom and stuff like that. So the PC industry was kind of moving towards 3D, but Super Mario 64 was just something that was above and beyond anything. And so that was really back when Nintendo was always on the cutting edge. So that was something I was really, really looking forward to. And that's something they really sold. And I bought into the whole Dream Team thing, all that kind of stuff. Like, I just loved it.
That is very much that whole, the technology aspect is pretty much what dominates the pre-release rhetoric and everything, the build-up to the Nintendo 64's launch. And what we're going to go through is actually, there's basically 3 years from the moment that Nintendo first officially announces that they're developing, you know, new hardware, new console, to when it actually came out in America. So it came out in America on September 29th of 1996.
The hubris years, as we call them.
But you have to go back to October of 1993.
Wow.
For when Nintendo actually announces it. So you compare that with, you know, 3DS, where they say it's going to be coming out, you know, in the next fiscal year, and that was what it ended up being. You know, they stuck to it. So it was about a 12-month lag between, you know, discovering this thing exists and actually having it. And I think with the Wii U, it's going to be, what, 18 months probably at most. So 3 years is a long time, especially in this day and age. So the first thing that Nintendo announced is that they were developing the hardware with Silicon Graphics. Now, they created workstations, you know, PCs for creating computer-generated imagery for films and things. And this was the hook. It's like, well, you know, we are going to have a console built by the same people that build the workstations that, you know, the special effects guys did for the T-1000 and the T-Rex in Jurassic Park and all, you know, these were, you know, relatively recent films at the time that were cutting edge with computer graphics. So, you know, the conjuring images of these CGI movies in your home, which obviously was a pretty far-flung thing. But the first thing they said was that this hardware design was going to enable them, in the words of Howard Lincoln, to skip a generation and go straight to 64-bit. So at the time...
More bits!
Yeah. At the time, you had Sega were preparing the Saturn. That was going to come out at the end of 94 in Japan and then 95 in America. Same for the PlayStation. At this point, the whole saga that we've referenced in the past with, you know, Sony and Nintendo kind of partnering on the CD add-on, and then Nintendo kind of stabbed them in the back and all that fell apart. Yeah, at this point, Sony was going it alone. They were going to release a 32-bit platform just like Sega. So they were saying, well, don't pay attention to those, because we're actually gonna, you know, just leap totally out in front of them. It's going to be completely more advanced. But more than that, they also said, from this point, quite, you know, 2 years out, they said it's going to launch before the end of 95 for $250. And now, bear in mind, the Saturn, when it eventually came out in America under bizarre circumstances, was $400.
Well earned. Nicely
so
done.
So Nintendo clearly were somewhat spooked, I think, by the fact that we were going to have Sony and Sega coming into their turf, and Sega had had a certain amount of success, especially up to this point, 93, in the console war in America. So I think particularly in the American market, they wanted to get out in front and say, we're going to have a machine that's bigger, better, and it's going to be out pretty soon after, if not before. It wouldn't be before, clearly, but it was going to be out a few months later and at a competitive price. So that, you know, seems like, well, Nintendo, they've got it all figured out. You know, they're looking good. But once you get to 94, and some of the details start emerging. So this is where he was called Ultra 64 for the first time. I think, I can't remember whether it was Ultra 64 and then Nintendo Ultra 64, but that was basically the name that was bandied around. And you had like a casing and stuff was shown. But the big thing was that they had decided, after all the farce of the CD-ROM add-on with the Super Nintendo and all that, that they wouldn't go with CDs for the new console, which was a huge and quite shocking decision at the time, because, you know, they had seemed to be moving in that direction before.
Yeah. I mean, and this is in the time of, you know, the 3DO, and a lot of, you know, consoles had CD add-ons, and
so they were being highly contrarian.
Yes, and highly, like, so.
Like I said, this is really like the high point of Nintendo hubris. I mean, you can go back to the discussion about it being 64 bits, like this is like some huge revelation. But besides TYP, who I presume knows the answer to this, do either of the two of you know what that means?
Exactly.
It means very little. It's just, all it means is the instruction set, yeah. Basically.
It's like, guys, I couldn't translate what that means until I had a bachelor's degree in computer science. It doesn't really matter.
Well, especially since we're talking about 4 megabytes of RAM. I mean, come on.
It's so absurd.
Well, there's a lot of oddities that came up in the final hardware design, but I mean, you know, that was basically buzzwords back then. I mean, bits were buzzwords, yes. You know, all that kind of thing.
Blast processing. I mean, that was the previous generation.
The way that Nintendo tried to spin the in terms of why did they go with cartridges? Well, there's a number of seemingly obvious reasons. One of the chief among them, I think, is the fact that it probably did enable them to make the hardware for less money, mm-hmm. without having all those moving parts of disk drive in it. Sure. That was some of the reason why they could seem to undercut Sony and Sega, who were having CD consoles. But of course, what it meant was that the games would be more expensive. But Nintendo probably, you know, had faith in their ability to sell their own games on that basis. The problem, of course, is that it makes it very expensive for the third parties who have to procure the cartridges from Nintendo, and there's a reset button that Carl did. I'm struggling to remember which specific one it was, where the developer in question went into some of the production line problems with the cartridge model, in terms of basically you're really gambling on, like, well, if you order this many from the platform holder and then you can't sell them, you've taken on a huge risk and you've lost money and all. Whereas with CDs, it's much cheaper and it's also less lag time involved. It was much better for third parties. So this decision was very controversial in that sense. And certainly, you know, some strained relationships, you know, that were already strained with Nintendo and some third parties broke, basically.
Well, I mean, this was Nintendo making a decision for Nintendo. And I don't necessarily mean that in the sense of they'll make more money off third parties. Nintendo was used to programming into tight sizes, you know, big games into small memory capacities, and to them that was part of their corporate knowledge. They didn't have a big problem with that, and CD-based games really did take a long time to load. Load times were a big deal. I did not like load times.
They were terrible. And if you've played Omega Boost, that's a great example. If you played Omega Boost on the PlayStation, you played wait times, and then you got to play Omega Boost between them. I mean, it was unbelievably terrible.
Yeah.
No, and this is how Nintendo tried to spin it, basically, was that, you know, CDs is just too slow for the kinds of games that we want to make, and moreover, the way they phrased it at the time, the kinds of games that we think the market wants. The action games, you know, we think about the games that were popular at the time, platformers, fighting games, you know, that sort of thing, especially the sports games, you know, the Western market. That's what they said. It doesn't really make sense for us on a market basis. But the other way they tried to spin it as well is the whole Dream Team thing you've already heard us mention a number of times. So if you can believe it, they actually tried to make a bullet point of the fact that they would have very few developers working on the N64, at least in the early stages. Yeah, so they were basically sort of trying to turn this move to cartridges, which was exclusionary, into one of exclusivity. So they assembled this dream team of developers. And the interesting thing about them is who they were. Because we, you know, if you think about what we talk about today, about how Japan-centric Nintendo is and all this stuff, and yet this dream team they put together, the people they were bringing into the inner circle to be allowed to touch the Ultra 64, you know.
Yeah.
Taste the ambrosia.
This is our elite core of developers. Come here, Iguana. You're great.
They are all Western developers. Not one
hey,
of Clay, them.
Hey, Clay, what's up?
Not yeah. one of them hailed from Japan. Not one. And in fact, a number of them had very little experience developing console games. Some of them were PC developers. And yep. some of them, like I think Angel Studios, I don't think they developed games at all.
No.
And Paradigm was a flight simulator company.
It yeah. sounds like they're an evil company in a bad N64 game.
And of course, they did go on to co-develop Pilot Wings with Nintendo, so that kind of made sense at least. But the two, you know, what I think of as the charter members were Rare and Midway. So, obviously, this was actually before we'd even seen Donkey Kong Country yet. Yeah, it had actually come out.
Yeah.
Obviously,
oh,
they'd
wow.
been developing it. Yeah, well, this is during 94, and obviously DKC was the holiday, you know, Christmas 94. So, you know, Rare and Midway, you know, they were sort of brought in as these guys that were going to not only sort of develop for the Ultra 64, but they were going to make arcade games that were, you know, ostensibly basically the Ultra 64 tech inside them that would sort of go out in front of the home console to kind of give people a taste of what was to come and basically sort of serve as marketing and get it out there. And of course, those games were Killer Instinct, the arcade version of that, and Cruisin' USA, which did eventually show up on the N64.
It did, kind of.
Yeah,
but
sorta.
In the case of Killer Instinct, it was actually the sequel, an enhanced version of the sequel, so it gives you an idea of how much time elapsed between these things. But, you know, this was it. This was their sort of gambit. It was like, well, you know what? All the developers that basically, you know, sold a lot of games on the Super Nintendo or the NES before, there was kind of like, you know, screw them. You know, to some extent, it was like, we've got this cast of characters here that are going to develop these, you know, cutting edge tech games for us on the new console. And that's really, you know, quality over quantity. But the problem is a lot of these developers were not necessarily household names. So I don't know how well that the sort of message carried through. But then when you get to the next year in 95, this is where the wheels really start to come off a bit, because, you know, they had intended at this point to be, as we said before, launching the console in Japan and America, at least, in 1995. But when it comes to E3, which would be the time that you reveal it to the press and give it the big showing, it wasn't ready. I mean, that's the simple fact of it. It was not ready at all. And so, yeah, that left the floor to Sega and Sony, who had already launched their consoles in Japan. They're about to do it in America. And that's where you got Sega saying, and it's on sale now. You know, that was their moment with the Saturn. So the actual system wasn't unveiled until Space World, back when, you know, you had Space World, at the end of that year. So when the system was supposed to be coming out, you were seeing it for the first time. And even then, you only had a couple of playable games of like 11 shown or something. But the big thing was they showed the controller for the first time, because this, you know, for me, following it, that was the big mystery. It was like they were saying, you know, they were implying that the controller was going to be revolutionary. You had some mock-ups, some of which were kind of based on the Virtual Boy controller design. Which, you know, you stick a middle prong in that thing, it's not that far.
Oh, but it doesn't have two D-pads. It's got this weird, the C buttons, but it's different.
Some of the mock-ups actually ended up being pretty close in terms of the three-prong design, this joystick in the middle of it, with a traditional D-pad of buttons on either side. That's what we got. And of course, when they showed it with Super Mario 64 playable, that really did sell people on what they were trying to do. The press reaction was hugely positive.
It's always regarded as being this incredibly bizarre controller, and it is, but it wasn't just designed to be weird. It was designed because they were at this junction point of 2D and 3D games, and ultimately it's a 2D controller and a 3D controller, depending on how you're holding it, which in the abstract seems like a great idea, but in practice it just doesn't quite work right. And you see that on the Wii, where they're like, well, we just need to have more controllers, which might not be the best solution either, but it always made it feel like, well, I have this third of the controller I'm never going to use.
Well, that was, I mean, some of that was the sort of software that ended up popular. You know, there were precious few games that actually were traditional 2D games that would have used the D-pad and buttons in that sort of orientation. And very often they tended to have analog stick control schemes anyway.
Right.
Because that was such the default way to hold the controller. They felt like people would probably just hold it that way in any event. So, I mean, the whole, like, halfway house thing kind of ended up being a bit silly. It probably should have just put all their chips in the 3D table. And
yeah, it does feel like they weren't quite sure where the industry was going, so they hedged their bets pretty hard.
It's strange, because so much of the thrust of the marketing was, it's 3D, we're doing it. And you know, I mean, they were marketing this thing even way before they nailed anything down, before there was even screenshots, or there were, in the magazines I was reading, there were adverts that said Ultra 64, it's coming, it's got the speed of cartridge, not CDSLOW, you know.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I'm sure on the one hand they didn't want it to come across like they were forcing people to make 3D games.
But on the other hand, that was the selling point. And in fact, the analog stick was not referred to as the analog stick. It was referred to as the 3D stick. That's what it's called. It was like, and some of that, I mean, I think technically the analog stick on the N64 isn't actually analog.
It's not.
Is digital, but it's digital in so many increments. It works essentially like an analog stick, but they called it a 3D stick, you know, because it's like, this makes true 3D gaming it in a 3D environment possible in a way that the Sega and Sony platforms didn't have yet with their interfaces. So that was, you know, a pretty big bombshell when that finally did get dropped. And I think Sega ended up having their ripoff, essentially the Saturn analog controller, out on the US market before the N64 even came out.
Yeah, I remember
seeing
that.
But, you know, at this point, obviously they conceded that the launch in all the territories was going to go back to 96, so they were getting behind schedule. And
it was an interesting forewarning.
They still didn't have many games, even then. You know, I mean, you know, so, well, it's delayed, but it's not as if they had, like, a lot of games that were in any state to be played. And so then when you go into 96, the year that is actually going to come out, it starts badly, because this is where Square officially get off the Nintendo bandwagon. And they had, like, done, I think, some tech demos using Silicon Graphics hardware of, like, a chocobo and like, some characters from FF6 battling and stuff. So it was like, well, yeah, they are in the process of got early development for a Final Fantasy game on the new Nintendo hardware. But, in 96, several months still before it would come out in Japan, Square said, it's not happening. We're going to PlayStation. So obviously that was a big blow. I mean, for me, I had only played Secret of Mana at that point. I had not even played Chrono Trigger yet. So I hadn't developed an appreciation for RPGs. They didn't interest me terribly much, but certainly with the magazines I was reading, the significance of that was still brought home to me.
Yeah.
That, you know, these games in Japan were massive. They were system sellers. And that this could hurt in a big way. But, I mean, for you, John, if you're someone who played Final Fantasy, what was your thoughts on it?
That's the thing. I mean, it was, I knew it was huge. It was a real downer, to say the least.
John was depressed for weeks.
Well, that's the thing, though. Like, what I didn't like about it is the fact that, like, I really had no interest in buying the PS1, really. Like, I just could not care about it. Actually, I didn't buy a PS1 until Final Fantasy VII came out. That was actually what, like, when that came out. So the PS1 had been on the market for what, like, at that point, like a year and a half or something?
A while, yeah.
And I pretty much, I was looking for every excuse not to buy one. I really didn't want one, and I was like, fine, you know, because it got great reviews. I was like, all right, I really want to play this game. And so I finally did break down and buy one. But yeah, that was kind of one of those things. It was the first real kind of chink in the armor sort of thing. Like, okay, maybe Nintendo really isn't doing the right thing, and maybe the N64 won't be as great in the long run as I thought it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a moment there for me thinking, you know, really what would happen in Japan. I mean, I didn't foresee how well Final Fantasy VII would do in America on PlayStation.
Yeah, I didn't either.
It's way better than any Final Fantasy game had before.
Yep.
But in terms of Japan, you're thinking, well, you know, I mean, Nintendo was so dominant during the Super Nintendo era.
Yep.
And yet now, you know, you wondered whether, you know, this was really going to, you know, put a dent in it, because the PlayStation had already been out there for more than a year when this announcement comes out. And a lot of those were not great games. It was a lot of arcade stuff. So, right. You know, it didn't seem like it was an insurmountable lead or anything like that. But when you get an announcement like that, definitely the sort of the seeds of doubt, I think, were planted with quite a lot of people.
Like, at the same time, though, to me, it was like, yeah, you know, that sucks, but RPGs were not nearly as big back then as they were, you know, later on.
Right. So Final Fantasy VII really is the catalyst for that, though, because it had this massive marketing pitch. I mean, they had all those, at the time, stunning videos that they had in their commercials, because that's what they could do on that hardware. In a way, Square Enix sort of said, or Square at that point said, you know, we can use this to make this game look a lot better than it actually is.
Well, the storytelling, I guess, you know, the ways they wanted to go could not be accommodated by the cartridge. I mean, that was a fact. And they made, I think, clearly the best commercial decision for them.
Yeah.
They were certainly vindicated in that fact.
Oh, definitely. I just remember the ad campaign for that game where they basically had all these explosions and it ended, you know, all these things, just all the pre-rendered videos cut together. And it ended with the shot of him shooting the motorbike over this hill and, like, going into the moon E.T. style. I mean, it was this most absurdist commercial I've ever seen for a game, yet I was like, that's really cool. Because games didn't look like that. Games just didn't look that way.
And the game didn't look like that.
No, it didn't. But you didn't know that for the commercial.
But to be fair, I mean, that was, you know, Nintendo, it's obviously getting a taste of their own medicine. I mean, you know, this was a company that, you know, had done stuff like Killer Instinct, essentially, as like an advanced marketing for Ultra 64. And what was that using? Like big pre-rendered characters and stuff. You know, that, you know, was not really representative of what games like Super Mario 64 and all that would look like eventually.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was a similar sort of thing with this CG sort of fetish that was going on at the time, partially because it was like novel in the movies. So, it was coming back on them a bit. But, and then in 96, eventually, it comes out in Japan in June, right?
Right.
And so for me, that was when the clock started, because I had a Japanese Super Famicom. I wanted the N64 as soon as possible, despite some of the sort of commercial, you know, waters looking a bit choppy. For me, I just wanted Mario 64.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. I wanted that now. The level of hyperbole, or it was not even hyperbole necessarily, because it was that revolutionary, but just the praise was astronomical.
Well, it was the first of its kind, right? I mean, it was literally the first game of its kind like that.
It wasn't the first attempt at a 3D platformer, but it really was kind of genesis at understanding how a 3D platformer should work.
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing else on the market like it.
So I have a bit of a different perspective from, I guess, the rest of you, because I wasn't really following the N64 up until its launch. This was before I was sort of actively on the internet, actively aware of press. You know, I was just playing my Super Nintendo, playing whatever games I got for presents and whatnot. And so my first experience with the N64 was really, well, maybe I saw some commercials, but my first real experience with the N64 was when I was at a friend's house who had one. And, like, they were playing Mario. I'm like, wow, this is really awesome. And I played some Mario. And, of course, you know, my sister's like, yeah, this is stupid. I want to play the Cruisin' USA game.
Oh, no.
So unfortunately, most of my experience with that the first, whatever, 3 days where I was on vacation with friends, were people playing Cruisin' USA. And I'm like, I really want to play Mario. But whatever, multiple people wanted to play Cruisin' USA. So I got to play, like 2 hours of Mario out in the corner when no one else is using it. And I'm like, I really want this game. Oh my God, I want this game.
I'm interested to know, though, but like, from the point of view, like, for me, when I finally got my hands on Super Mario 64, you know, I was like the guy that had, you know, visualized himself throwing the touchdown pass in the Super Bowl to win the game a million times. Like, you know, this is something I'd dreamed about over and over again, looking at the screenshots, reading the reviews, all that. You know, the expectation was just crazy, out of control. Now, contrast with you.
I had no expectations. I just said, whoa, this is a new Mario game. Holy crap, this is crazy. You know, and I have to learn everything from scratch. And it was just, I just had a lot of fun with it. It's just completely different. But, you know, that was sort of my experience with most video games up until I started following the online scene. You know, it's like, okay, well, I got a new Zelda game. Oh, cool. This is great. So to me, it's, you know, ignorance is bliss in a way. And, you know, I came into this without any preconceptions, and it was just fantastic. It was unlike anything else I had played.
I had followed it, but conceptually, I think I had a hard time wrapping around what they mean when they start talking about like 3D gameplay and understanding like analog control concept because I was 9.
But that's a funny point, though, because if you look at the stuff that they were disseminating to the magazines about the Dream Team, about the tech and all this stuff, these are magazines I was reading, somebody was like 11 or whatever, 11, 12 years old, that I felt a lot of the stuff in it was aimed at an age group beneath me.
Right.
And yet they're talking about, like you said, all this stuff about polygonal environments, 3D worlds, analog controls, and the ridiculous hardware stuff, like anti-age aliasing.
Right.
To this day, I remember trilinear bitmap interpolation for making the.
They were literally being obtuse.
It's for getting rid of pixelated textures, basically, which is the smeared look that everyone complains about the N64. It's always part of the smeared look. But I mean, the point is, this back when video games were much more considered to be the province of the young. Kids, boys, right. They were putting this stuff out that was just, as you said, really, it was tech terms, but as buzzwords.
They had divorced them from the actual meaning of the phrases they were using. Because it no longer mattered.
They were meant to dazzle.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that worked on me to a large extent. And so when I remember, it was August, I think, actually. We'd just moved house. We'd moved house very much closer to the import game store that I'd been mail ordering from for all my Super Nintendo games. So it's like, let's screw it. Let's get on a train and we'll go and get it. Don't risk it getting damaged in the post or lost or whatever. Let's just go to the physical store now that we're closer and pick it up. And so and then we got there and they couldn't give us one that day.
Oh man!
And I tell you, it was for a kid that was tough. That level of excitement, being disappointed was tough.
Well, it was tough to get your hands on that stuff, even when it first came out in the U.S. I remember, my mom was, scrambling around just to find another controller, probably wound up paying way over normal price.
It's an interesting thing with the launch, because by the time, they brought it out in June in Japan, and that only had 3 games. Mario 64, mm-hmm. Pilot Wing 64, and a Japanese chess game or something.
Shogi-ji, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, it's pitiful. Frankly.
And I defy anyone listening to this show to know how to play shogi, because I sure as hell don't.
But, Super Mario 64 was so huge that it still did quite well in Japan on day one. Its day one sales of 300,000 was far in excess of how Sony and Sega got started with the PlayStation and Saturn in Japan. And, pretty much one-to-one, they were buying Mario 64. I mean, this is a game that went on to sell over 10 million units for a console that only sold 30 million units.
Yeah. It had a high attach rate. Yeah.
It was very direct that people were buying the system for this one particular game. But when it came to releasing it in America, you still didn't have any more games. In fact, taking Shogi out of it, you were down to 2 on launch day, just Mario 64 Pilot Wings. But the interesting thing is that they'd left it so long that Sony had actually come in then and cut their price. So they started at 300, but by the time you get to September of 96, they'd actually come down to 200. So now Nintendo's original plan of releasing at 250, that plan that went all the way back to 3 years earlier, they said, right, we're kind of starting to get a bit worried about Sony, building momentum and establishing a foothold in the US market. So they also went down to 200. And moved it up a day, I think, from the 30th to the 29th.
Wouldn't it be proactive, move it up a day?
They were, they knew they had a problem on their hand with so few games in the pipeline. They were really betting it all on one game, and they knew they had to get competitive on price. And so they did. And in fact, as TYP says, it did really well to start with. It came out very strong in the US, and I think through the whole holiday season, through Christmas, Thanksgiving, all that, it was very difficult to get hold of. Now, some of that might have been production line issues, but I think the fact is that Super Mario 64 was so acclaimed, and people clearly, when they did play it, connected with it, and then, it got other people to play it, sort of like as TYP was recounting himself, that it did sell the system by itself for that period, which is, hugely impressive. And I think, being that it was an experimental game, a groundbreaking game and all that, I mean, if Mario 64 had not been as good as it was, the N64 could have been an immediate disaster.
Yeah.
This at least gave it a chance to get going.
You know, it really, this discussion shows just how different an era it was for Nintendo and for the video game industry, because, like, with the Super Nintendo, I would argue Mario World really sold a huge number of the systems. That's why I got it. And obviously, Super Mario Brothers is when the NES really took off in the U.S. For the GameCube, there really wasn't that kind of killer launch title.
No.
For Wii, they did, but for 3DS, I mean, it's almost, in some ways, parallels some of the discussions we've been talking about with some of these other systems, where it's like, well, it kind of had a slow start because there wasn't any real notable game per se.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think with the way that went with the N64, of course, yeah, it wasn't, I don't think they called it the Nintendo 64 until that Space World, actually. I think it was that late that they made the Switch. But the thing with the N64 was that if they'd had other games, smaller games, less ambitious games, ready to go, maybe they could have launched the system sooner, because they were worried about the two competitors getting a foothold in the markets. But the problem was they had nothing else. They literally had the Super Mario 64 was as far along as anything, and it simply was not ready until the second half of 96. I mean, with the 3DS, at least they could say, well, we've got Pilot Wings and Nintendogs, and, you know, we might not have Super Mario 3D Land or Mario Kart, but we've got stuff. I mean, the thing with the N64 is that software development with this hardware was just so far behind, they had no choice. They had to wait until Mario 64 was ready.
And part of that was learning a new and, to be honest, weird hardware. But part of it was also just switching to a new development paradigm. I mean, they're moving from developing these 2D relatively simple titles into having to understand what it takes to program a 3D environment, understanding the dynamics of having a camera in that space, and trying to get to the point where they could say, okay, these are the core gameplay fundamentals that make a 3D game work. And you can kind of see that in Mario 64, where, you know, we've talked about this in the past, they had to show you the camera, literally show you the camera operator, so you could kind of understand what was going on.
They personified it with Lakitu.
Right, but they also had to develop a new kind of game structure. I mean, really, all the Mario games up to that point where you go from A to B. But they realized in this 3D world, you can't really do that because there's no straight line. You're moving around. So what they had to do is they had to put the objectives in different places, and that became the stars. So the same world could get recycled. And it had to be because they were huge and hard to build. But they also had to come up with the new kind of way of having a goal in a space where you're not just forced to go in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's more than just learning a new system. That's learning a new way of thinking. And I can understand why it took a long time for them to get going on games. And if you look at a lot of what came out for the Sega Saturn, especially, it was 2D games. Mm-hmm.
And also it was arcade conversion. If it was polygonal, it was like Virtua Racing and the Virtua Fighter and all that kind of stuff. You know, on PlayStation, you had stuff like, you know, Toshinden or Ridge Racer. Or, you know, I mean, they were, you know, arcade games or arcade style games that use polygonal graphics, where you weren't talking about a paradigm shift in game design.
Right. You were talking just about making more complicated models. It wasn't until Nintendo started doing this experiment stuff that it really started to push everybody in that direction, because they sort of laid a groundwork. This is what a 3D platformer looks like. This is what you have to do. And they've never tried to make a go from A to B 3D game until they made kind of the Sunshine levels a little bit, but really Galaxy and then Galaxy 2 in the extreme. But even then, they still kind of have a little bit of the exploration in there. But it almost feels a bit regressive, but not in a bad way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, it's going to be a topic that we kind of get into now. So, I mean, that covers the pre-release period. You went from all this techno supremacy stuff to...
It's going to be able to do 630 computations.
But, and to be fair, by all accounts, the hardware was done. The hardware didn't hold up jack shit. It was all about the problems getting the games done that really, you know, why it got delayed a number of times and why there were so few games in the early going.
That has to be the farthest in advance Nintendo ever had a console done, though.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I think Silica Graphics at least said they had it done in early 95, you know, I guess it preparing for launch at the end of that year. So it's, I mean, that whole thing was very, so much unlike what we have now.
Wii U's not even half done yet, guys. We got to get this thing done.
Well, some of the things you hear, make you want
it's a little frightening.
But so we're now going to move on into the games. We really want to talk about what this sort of environment that had been created by this 3 years, what sort of software library did it create? And so for the purposes of assessing that, I had us all compile lists of 15 for the anniversary games, but with a twist. So as the rap, you know, well earned in most respects with the N64 is that all the games were made by Nintendo on Rare. So my sort of somewhat challenge was to say everyone on their 15 list, at least 5 have to be games that were developed by people other than Nintendo and Rare.
And to be fair, some of those were not developed by Nintendo and Rare. They were developed on the behest of Nintendo and or Rare.
Yes, exactly. But this is what happens when you have a system like Nintendo did, where they ended up having like lesser developer support and they were sort of behind in sales and all that. They end up publishing more stuff themselves. They essentially might throw money at people to make a game for them, and then so they'll publish it, but it's still developed by someone else. Creatively, it's the work of someone else, you know? And so that's the thing. There are actually, you know, a number of N64 games maybe people think of as Nintendo games, but creatively they're not, you know, but they were just in a position where they had to do these things. It's like, you know, when Sega would make all those arcade ports.
Yeah.
Sega published vast, vast majority probably of early Mega Drive games, I would have thought, you know, to try and get that going. So similar thing here, but I wanted to focus, you know, to some extent on the developers behind these games as well as the publishers. But we're going to begin now. So John, if you'd like to take us through your favorite, this, we sort of said with this, there'd be a favorite sort of 15, not necessarily, you know, the best or anything. We're not getting into that and we're not ordering them or anything like that. This is, you know, personal picks.
Yeah, my personal picks, Ocarina of Time, Super Mario 64, Super Smash Brothers, F-Zero X, GoldenEye, Banjo-Kazooie, Mario Golf, Blast Corps, Sin and Punishment, Mario Kart 64, Mario Tennis, all of the Aki wrestling games. There were 4 of them and they were all fantastic. Bomberman 64, Mischief Makers, and NFL Blitz.
So John just likes violence, apparently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, there's a number of trends that I think are interesting in there. I think, first of all, you know, something that I probably, you know, people might sort of find interesting contrasting with the Super Nintendo era, the N64 became a very robust sports game platform. Mm-hmm. It became, you know, there was a vast number of different kinds of sports games that were on there that were, you know, really quite good. Obviously, the Mario stuff that mm-hmm. Lindy mentioned there. Madden did get on the platform. FIFA got on the platform. The major EA stuff.
Every year. Also, yeah.
You know, Acclaim, who were part of the Dream Team, and so they were in from the ground floor.
The Nightmare Team.
They had well-regarded sports games. Quarterback Club at the time was quite well thought of.
Yep.
And also All-Star Baseball. I had All-Star Baseball 99. That was a pretty good baseball game, even back then. I really enjoyed that, even not necessarily being the biggest fan of baseball or the most knowledgeable about it. I thought it was just a fun sports game to play. And then you had NBA Courtside.
Wayne Gretzky's 3D Hockey.
That's right. Wayne Gretzky's 3D Hockey.
Yep. And there was Ken Griffey baseball stuff still being done. You know, they kind of went back to Super Nintendo, but I think there was one on N64 as well.
1080 Snowboarding.
Well, a lot of this is a function of the N64 really being the party game system. I mean, much was the multiplayer
4 control ports
gaming system of choice. The 4 controllers, just the, you know, early on with like games like Mario Kart, established it as, you know, this is a good game if you want to have a bunch of friends over. This is a good system to own.
And in fact, that continued through the GameCube and Wii, actually. That these are the this is a multiplayer centric console, which it's kind of goes back to advance time a little bit when Nintendo talked about online play, specifically with the GameCube. Well, it's more important to have fun with people in the room.
But what's interesting is that obviously Nintendo themselves exploited it a hell of a lot. Right?
Oh, yeah.
They had Mario Kart was early. So I think that actually came out before the end of 96 in Japan. So it was a pretty early game. But down the line, stuff like Smash Brothers, Mario Party, I mean, these are games that were, you know, almost entirely based on the idea of playing it with 4 people. Mm-hmm. It didn't necessarily hardly work at all without it. But then in the West, it was the sports games that also picked up on that. And that's the thing. Some of it was just a lot more successful in the US than it was anywhere else. You know, it was basically playing the role of the Genesis in a way. Meanwhile, Sega were playing the role of being well on the way out of the hardware business. they kind of fell into that role. Sports games, bigger in America, you know, that sort of thing. Nintendo, I think, it's the one thing that they took from the N64 experience, I think, in a positive way through to Wii, is that local multiplayer is, you know, of real value. And
right.
That it's something that they could maybe do better than other platforms. I mean, pretty much everything else about the N64 is completely the opposite of the Wii.
I think it's still instructional to keep in mind that when the successors for the N64 era systems came out, the PlayStation still only had two control ports.
Yeah, I know.
It's like, crazy. What are you on?
Well, we'll sell you a multi-tap.
That's right. But it's,
yeah, exactly. Well.
But Nintendo very clearly put all four control ports right there in the front. It's like the key design feature of the front of the GameCube is the four control ports.
Yep.
It's actually highlighted by a gray frame. It says, this is what the system is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's funny because, like, you know, in terms of your Mario 64 pilot wings, you know, the very beginning, you really didn't have a reason to have another controller. But yeah, I mean, it became it was a huge part of the identity of the console.
Well, I think it was a large reason why there was such a controller shortage. It's like everyone just had one controller for Mario and pilot wings. And then Mario Kart 64 came out. Everyone wanted four controllers.
Yep.
And then you got stuck with the crazy controllers from the third parties.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
yeah, they were
hideous.
I have
to say, just for reference, the N64 had the absolute worst third-party controllers of any system ever.
Yeah, they were like, yeah, hell, if Nintendo's doing something that weird, we can do whatever the hell we want.
My personal favorite was my cousin had this, and it literally was the N64 controller, but they lopped off the two control prongs and just put connective plastic down the length of the middle one. So it was like this wedge. Oh my god. It was the least it would be like standing in an Iron Maiden in your hands to play the game. It was
a thing that I thought was impressive about it, though, in a way, is the way the Nintendo and Rare, you know, as well, like, they brought this sort of ethos to games that I don't think were obvious at the time. You know, we talked at length before about GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, how they put like party game shooters, but that idea before that of, you know, being in the same room, just that you could have a first person shooter that was that much of a lark, I think was, you know, not something that other people would have thought of. It's not something I thought, you know, FPSs could be fun in that way until they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then like Smash Brothers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting games, you had obviously the era of dominance with 16-bit with the one-on-one fighting games. And then in the 32-bit era, they kind of split off a bit into, you know, ones that remained, you know, strictly 2D, and then the sort of, you know, the Virtua Fighter,
right,
or the Tekken style. But this was just completely different altogether.
Yeah, it was fun.
Exactly. I mean, it was, I tell you, I mean, I remember debating in my mind, you know, it became a thing, playing four-player games with me and my friends, you know, especially GoldenEye, I think, really cemented it. But when Smash Brothers came out in Japan, you know, I was thinking about getting it because there was, you know, good reviews for it in terms of saying it was a great multiplayer game. But I was like, well, we don't have that many get-togethers. You know, it doesn't happen that often. And, you know, importing Japanese N64 games was bloody expensive. And of course, people said the one-play content was non-existent because it was. And so, you know, it was like, this is a tough decision. But I ended up getting it. On the first day, I think it paid for itself in amusement value. It was like an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
How shocking, how fun it was. This completely different spin on a fighting game concept. It just riotous fun. You know, I mean, I still play Smash Brothers regularly now, but when it was fresh, I can't describe how fun it was. That had to be the highlight.
It was kind of like, you know, why hadn't somebody done this before? It seems so simple and so easy, but I mean, that's partially because it's being made by Nintendo, but it just seemed almost like, yeah, this is the kind of game for people that don't want to sit there and involve themselves in a fighting game. They just want to hop in there and, you know, kick some butt. Why hasn't somebody done this before?
I do think, though, some of the reason why that some people hadn't done some of these things before is exactly what James said. You hadn't had an as-standard four-player console before.
Exactly.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, for people, yeah, you still had to buy the four controllers, maybe, or maybe people would bring their, you know, they might bring them over. But, you know, you had to buy extra controllers, maybe. But the feeling that it's like, yeah, this is what the console's set up to do. So people didn't feel like it was some, like, weird extravagance
mm-hmm.
to set up a four-player game.
Setting up the multi-tap wasn't super easy either. Like, you had to have it know what control port. It had to be in, like, the second control port, I think. And then you had to...
It was like playing Rock Band before Rock Band existed.
A little bit, yeah. But not wireless Rock Band either. Like, exactly. Like hardwired Rock Band. It was weird. It was a weird thing to have to do. And the one time I ever did it, I remember thinking, this is really stupid.
Well, the whole concept of doing that was stupid just because... It's fragmenting the market, you know. It's another hardware device that people have to buy that doesn't come with the system.
Tell Nintendo that.
Well, they learned their lesson with the N64 for the 4-player ports, but they maybe they've lost sight of that.
The Franken stick.
A little off target. I would say, though, that with this discussion of the shooters that John had mentioned, if you really have to put yourself in the mindset of what the first-person shooter was at that time. Now, it had started to evolve beyond that, but we weren't that far removed from the Dooms, the Castlevania, I mean,
Castle Wolfenstein.
There we go. And then sort of the less mature games like the 3D Realm stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The corridor games, that kind of thing.
I mean, they had LAN play, but you had to play them on different PCs.
Right. I mean, even on N64, let's not forget, you know, the thing that laid down the marker for FPS on N64 was Turok. It was a very early game.
Right.
It was a Dream Team game. It was Acclaim, Iguana, making it was shown in the press materials by Nintendo, you know, for a long time. It was hyped.
Right.
Even though it was third party and there wasn't necessarily that much third party stuff. And of course, you know, the big thing about it at the time was, oh, it's bloody, it's gory. You know, after some of the farcical situations that happened on Super Nintendo with Mortal Kombat and all that, you know, it's like, oh, well, this system, again, sort of like the Genesis, you know, if you want the bloody stuff, you know, you can come and get it here.
Nintendo does what Nintendo don't, is what you're telling me?
Nintendo didn't.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was what laid down the marker for the genre on the system, and I had it, and that was my first FPS, Turok. I kind of considered putting it on my list. It isn't on my list, mainly because the game just isn't good enough.
Yeah,
it's not good.
Aged very, very poorly.
I did enjoy it at the time.
Oh, yeah.
It was my first FPS, and it solidified the console could do this. You know, it could support sort of credible FPS games, despite some very significant limitations. And at the same time, though, this was completely one player. There was no multiplayer in the original Turok. And, you know, so again, for me, GoldenEye was also a game that was shown from very early on because it was originally a Super Nintendo project. It had been in the works for ages. And so, you know, when I was getting excited about GoldenEye, the multiplayer was an afterthought. I was just like, well, it's going to be like Turok, but it's Bond, and there's going to be stealth, and you're being a secret agent. I did not the multiplayer ahead of time until maybe the reviews, but even then, it just didn't cross my mind that this could be something that I'd be playing for months, years hence.
So the Turok sequel, that was before was after GoldenEye, right?
Yeah, Turok 2 was about a year after GoldenEye, and that did have multiplayer because
As it was known in Japan, Violence Killer, Turok, New Generation.
Really?
That's so great.
That is the name of the game in Japan.
Wow. If there was any blood in the game, there it is.
Violence Killer, : Turok, New Generation.
Yep. Go out and buy it for your children today.
I'm going to guess that wasn't its title in Germany.
No, it would have been Band Game, Band of Band, Band, Turok.
Yeah,
2.
I can't imagine how censored that got. Because, I mean, they got pretty silly with the cerebral bore and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
So, I mean, the FPS, to be in general, and obviously the multiplayer component post GoldenEye, it was a big part of the platform. You had all sorts of ports from PC, you know, Quake and Hexen and Doom, and you know, there was plenty of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But at the same time, there's a lot of original content too. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, it helped popularize the console shooter in a big way, and of course, it's something that Nintendo. You know, as Chris Kohler pointed out when he was doing the episode with Johnny 175 episodes ago, it was something Nintendo really failed to capitalize upon.
Mm-hmm.
But let's move on there to James. Would you like to go through your list?
My list is eccentric because
James, very deliberately, to be fair, again, this is not about the top games or anything like that. This is James. James is trying to highlight a lot of areas of the software library that are a bit more off the beaten track.
Yeah, I read the directives on the instructions. Much more objective based as to get get out there and try to avoid overlap. So,
well, I'm glad you did. Let's just put it that
keep that in mind. So mine are alphabetized. There's no real order to them. Banjo-Tooie, Conker's Bad Fur Day, Gauntlet Legends, Harvest Moon 64, Jet Force Gemini, which pointing out right now, there's kind of a trend in the middle here, or at the top.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah, The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask, Major League Baseball featuring Ken Griffey Jr., the second Ken Griffey game on the N64, to be fair.
Oh.
Mega Man 64, Milo's Astro Lanes, which is kind of like the first sports power-up game I ever saw about bowling. Mission Impossible, the movie, the game. Ogre Battle 64, Person of Lordly Caliber, which everyone expected was going to be on this list.
Oh, yeah.
Pokemon Snap, Ready to Rumble Boxing, Star Wars Episode 1, Battle for Naboo, and Star Wars Episode 1, Racer, or Pod Racer, depending on which version you have.
Well, there's a couple of trends that I want to pull out of that. First of all, so
James is like, I'm this many fingers old.
the minor trend first is Star Wars games, because this was the place to go for Star Wars games. Straight out of the gate, in Europe, Shadows of the Empire was actually a launch game in March 97, but it was an early game elsewhere, and you know, I don't know how great it was. It was
kind of janky, and sometimes you fell through the ground and couldn't get out.
The iffy reviews put me off it, and listeners could probably guess from the litany of Palpatine quotes, sometimes explicit, sometimes implicit, that are said on this show. I adore Star Wars, but I was not swayed by Shadows of the Empire, or in fact any of the Star Wars games on the system, bizarrely. But I did play quite a bit of Rogue Squadron on a friend's system, and that was really good, to be fair.
Yeah, and Battle for Naboo sort of gets overlooked a bit because it was a late game.
Technically, it is a marvel, from what I understand.
It is significantly more attractive than Rogue Squadron. It has a much better draw distance. It's got a better frame rate. And it introduces the sort of ground-based combat, which like people seem to be 50-50 on. I kind of liked it. I thought it broke up the game a bit. There's more types of craft in the game, even when you're flying, and it introduced the ability to change craft mid-level, which meant levels didn't feel the same all the way through, or you weren't stuck with the bomber if you had to fly a long distance. You could jump out and fly something else. And actually, it did a better job with narrative, too, to an extent. Now, granted, it has the Episode 1 veneer, which turns people off a bit. But to me, it was almost more fun, although I have to be completely honest that I played its predecessor more. And I would have put its predecessor on here in its stead, even though it's a better game, but I was trying to be a bit on the edge.
Well, I mean, obviously that's better known, especially because of the GameCube sequel as well.
And it's sort of set the stage for this game, too.
It did. And I played some of that on a friend's system. It was really good. And I did consider kind of going back to get it, but then the sequel, you know, became known, and I was quite happy to sort of wait for that. But the racing game, the pod race stuff, that was also quite well thought of, as I recall.
Right. And if I've mentioned this on the show before, but I got my N64 with the Pod Racer bundle.
Yes.
Which meant that I had the weird N64 box that had looked like in front of a Pod Racer. But that game is really outstanding. I mean, it is. If they had released that on the Virtual Console, which they never would, I would have bought it in a heartbeat. Because it's a very fast game, which makes sense if you understand where the origin of the franchise comes from. But as far as a racing game goes, it's very fast and it feels very dangerous, and there's a lot of crashing.
You are practically quoting Episode 1 there, James.
It's I'm not sure how best to describe it, but there's a lot of time spent going sideways trying to squeeze through tight spaces. And
I mean, how would you compare it to F-Zero X that was on John's list?
I would say it's more kinetic than F-Zero X, and there's a lot more just chaos, because a lot of times you're coming up on someone who isn't quite as fast as you, but is bigger than you. And you're like, okay, I can't hit him. I cannot hit him.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, if you think of the pod race sequence in Episode 1, I mean, the difference between the crafts is massive. Like, Anakin's is really small.
Yeah.
And then it's a Bulba's is huge. And like, so, yeah, it carries over into the game.
Oh, yeah. And there's some really amazing settings to the game, because it's not just racing around the Tatooine racetrack. There's racetracks all over the Star Wars universe. And some of them are really creative. Some of the races are really, really hard. And there are some stages that are just plain evil. Like, it's like F-Zero GX kind of evil, where you're like, okay, I'm going along, and oh god, there goes the ground.
Did that have multiplayer like F-Zero X?
I believe it did. Now, I know that the N64 version is considered definitive. There was a PS2 port that's considered to be subpar, and the Dreamcast version that's supposed to be closer to the N64 version. There's also this arcade game that came out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that. I never played it.
Which actually has, if you remember the scene from episode one, they don't control it with a steering wheel or a yoke. They have two thrust controllers, one on each side, and they level them in and out. So if you pull it all the way back, you're thrusting in reverse. If you push it forward, you're going straight. So if you want to turn, you pull one up and push one back.
Yeah.
And I played the arcade game a bunch of times, and it's so impossible just to coordinate like that you just wreck. It's, I mean, the game is so hard as it is, you just end up wrecking all the time.
It's just, I asked with the multiplayer, because I was really surprised, actually, with F-Zero X, at how fun that was in multiplayer. Because you think of F-Zero X, and you think, oh, you think of F-Zero in general, you think it's a really hardcore racing game, you know, if you're just a lot better than your friends, you know, because you own it and they don't. You're a lot more familiar with the tracks and stuff. How fun could it be? But the whole element of trying to kill each other, boosting, sacrificing health, and the roulette of death, you know, when people were dead, they could still influence the game.
Right.
That was fun as a party game. I mean, that's how crazy the N64 was for party stuff. Even F-Zero became good in that way.
I believe it was a two-player game.
Two player. I mean, the thing is, F-Zero is really stripped down.
Right.
So you could probably handle four player split, but I guess Episode 1 Racer was more detailed, right?
Yeah, it was actually a really good looking game for the time frame. And it had big stages. Like, as you went through the racetracks, you saw things from the movie and recognized them instantly. Like, oh yeah, that's the area where they have all the audience at. But it's pretty cool. I mean, it's a really fun game that they almost should have made a sequel to that wasn't a port, because it really didn't deserve it. I mean, it would have sold, because this game actually sold really well.
Yeah, that's what I remember. But I mean, but obviously you would have, you know, it wouldn't have been as topical after, you know, because that was relatively close to the movie coming out. But
yeah, but I mean, it, as far as games go, it did really well on the N64. I don't know about any of the ports, but it was a really cool game.
Well, as we said, the N64 from an early phase, because of LucasArts' association with the Dream Team and all that, it became the Star Wars console at a time where you had the special editions coming out in the cinema and then Episode 1 coming out in the cinema. So it was important. It was quite a big deal at that time. But to move on from the Star Wars thing, James, obviously, as you mentioned, the other theme in your list is Rare. Rare's games.
Yes.
And now, kind of what I wanted to bring up for all of us here is there is sort of a strand of thought that Rare's games on the N64 were clearly technically superior to just about anyone else's.
Right.
Even Nintendo's, arguably. Yeah, because they were so intimately familiar with the hardware from an early stage, and they were so close to Nintendo that they got more out of the system. No one would argue with that. But that in retrospect, the games themselves were not actually very good. That is a sort of strain of thought that exists, and I wanted to hear what, you know, obviously you've got a number of them in your list, James. So I assume you would disagree.
I would disagree to an extent.
Right.
I would say that oftentimes they sort of built on what Nintendo had already done in a genre. Nintendo would do a genre and then just move on.
Right.
Like, all right, we did that genre, we're good now. And then Rare would sort of come behind and go, okay, what did they do? All right, let's take this a step further. And they would sort of set up shop in that genre for one or two games, and then they'd move on to follow wherever Nintendo went next time. They were sort of like the first renovations in it, without the blueprint Nintendo laid down.
Yeah, that's a fair statement, and sometimes it worked out really well, other times it didn't. One game I didn't put on my list, but maybe I should have, is Diddy Kong Racing, which is a really good kart racer.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I actually had that instead of Mario Kart, basically, and I was not disappointed. I mean, certainly the single-player stuff is more robust,
yeah.
And
oh,
it's
definitely
more imaginative and all that, but, you know, the multiplayer could be fun too. So, I mean, that was very well made, and it was a pattern that became established. As James says, that basically Nintendo would lay down a template, and then Rare would riff off it in some sense. So I mean, you could go back to DKC for that to some extent, but obviously everyone was riffing off that template at the time.
Right.
But, you know, Mario 64 to Banjo-Kazooie, Mario Kart 64 to Diddy Kong Racing, Zelda to Dinosaur Planet,
right,
which eventually, of course, became Star Fox Adventures. You know, this was a very consistent pattern, which is somewhat curious that you would have this developer that was so close to you doing things that were a bit duplicative.
I do wonder, though, if that was the objective of the relationship, though. Nintendo would sort of go there, and then Rare would sort of follow them and make the second follow-up game and flesh out the lineup.
And, of course, Rare were charged in a very significant way with just filling out the lineup.
Yeah.
I mean, they were incredibly prolific in this period.
And considering how much of a bad rep they get for just being terrible about delays.
Well, there were a lot of delays, but again, it was like, well, but they had like
so many games.
5 games in the pipeline and stuff. I mean, they did 2 Banjo games, they did Diddy Kong Racing, they did Blast Corps, they did Conker right at the end.
They did DK64.
So, DK64, Mickey Speedway, another racing game. Like, I mean, they were really busy during this time, by necessity.
Right. Well, and they did GoldenEye and Perfect Dark. Right.
GoldenEye, Perfect Dark, as we already mentioned.
I mean, it's
so,
kind of
so I think it's a little unfair to label Rare as just following whatever Nintendo did, because, I mean,
no.
Some of their bigger budget titles, yeah, they did, but GoldenEye was a Rare product. Nintendo would never...
No.
Develop that game. They never will develop a game like that.
Yeah. Not in all cases, but they did do a lot of it.
They did a lot of it. That was a significant part of their remit, it seemed like, is that, you know, you will sort of populate the system with games of which, you know, we've already sort of popularized. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, they did things that were, you know, more off the beaten track. GoldenEye, Blast Corps in particular is very unique.
Yep.
And Jet Force Gemini as well was quite ahead of its time, you could argue.
Yeah, and that, when I said that I would to an extent argue that their games aren't very good, that's where the extent kicks in, is Jet Force Gemini, which in retrospect is kind of a janky game. But
I see, I've got, getting ahead of myself, I do have that on my list, which I'll share shortly, but, you know, I don't disagree in the sense that it's a bit rough around the edges, but at the same time, I think, you know, because it was relatively unique at the time, and it was very impressive.
Oh, there's no question.
The soundtrack, the graphics, and all that kind of stuff, and it was hard. That's one of the things I liked about it. Some of those bosses were really difficult.
The last boss of the game is infamous for being just a complete bastard. But there are websites devoted to how big of an asshole he is. And I mean like 1999 websites. Like somebody spent hours writing HTML by scratch to describe how much of a jerk he is. I mean, it's awful. But at the same time, the game deserves its credit, but it doesn't hold up particularly well.
Well, Rare's big mistake was they seem to go to the well once too often with certain games and certain franchises, where they would bring out games that, this is just like the other game that they just released, only with a couple extra levels.
Well, I mean, in some cases, they actually ended up completely... like, Conker was basically that.
It was all happy and fun.
At one point, it was going to be like, didn't you make this game already with a bear instead of a squirrel? You know? And then, you know, obviously they completely changed it and it took ages to come out. And
they turned him into a bastard.
Well, not before the Game Boy game, which I sadly owned and beat.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got Conker on your list there. I mean, how do you think that holds up as a game?
Holds up a damn sight better than Gex Enter the Gecko.
I mean, in terms of presentation, it's still very impressive.
It is. And
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, the presentation of Conker is its strong suit. You know, the fact that, like, you had a lot of voice acting was pretty unique on the N64.
But actually, the writing, I mean, it's crass and juvenile, but it's still, I mean, there's parody in there, there's some satire, there's...
It's filled with film parodies, with mm-hmm. fourth wall breaking.
To an extent... The level of crassness in the game is intended as sort of a meta joke. Like,
right.
Like they went and turned this cute character into this extremely offensive thing, not because they thought being offensive was funny, or maybe they did, but they also recognized that this cute character being this offensive is so absurd that it almost adds its own second layer of humor. So Conker's constantly being put in these situations that he's offensive, but they're way more offensive than he is, and he's sort of having this reaction with the person playing the game where he sort of breaks the wall between the game and the player and sort of looks at you and gives you this look like, what the hell am I doing?
Well, it was just in terms of the cinema scenes and all that, I mean, they were quite well handled, I think, in most cases.
Oh, yeah, the Matrix ending of the game is amazing.
the Matrix stuff, the Private Ryan stuff. I mean, there's loads of things.
The D-Day scene is out. Is the game, the mini game that came out of that is absolutely amazing. And the Reservoir Dog stuff. But the fact that the last boss battle doesn't even happen, that you get there and the game just breaks, and then he proceeds to make fun of the programmers for 10 minutes and then just announces that, okay, I guess I win, and that's the end of the game. It's just like in my head when this happened to me, I was probably 15. Right, I'm like, yeah. This is amazing.
So I rented this game and I played through it pretty quickly in one rental period, and it still, to me, has the most interesting pacing of pretty much any game I've played. Maybe it's because I don't play many of these short action-y games on modern systems now, but it just sort of has its own unique flair and pacing. It's just like, I didn't know exactly what was going to happen next.
It was punchy.
It also had a very different structure. I think, you know, if you compare it to the 3D platformers that you had at the time,
right.
Banjo, Mario, they had a very transparent structure.
Right.
About, well, it's 120 stars or it's 100 jiggies or whatever. And it's like you got
800,000 gold bananas.
Yeah,
yes.
Really.
Yeah. With this, it was more taking you on a journey. Like, and you didn't know where you were going to go.
You know, when I said that the Galaxy was kind of regressive, this game was a bit regressive too, because ultimately there was a large amount of A to B. And to an extent, there was still a lot of world exploration. Like, you need to go beat up the pitchfork and the paintbrush because they're getting on my nerves.
Didn't you have to collect money for a certain amount of things?
And to an extent, Rare started to make fun of themselves a bit because they put googly eyes on everything in that game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Including the money, and then they turned the money into this foul-mouthed asshole that Conker has arguments with. So it's like you're collecting him, but you just want to stay away from him. It's brilliant, and I don't think I've seen anyone engage in that kind of self-satire in the industry ever.
Yeah, well, Rare have kind of kept that a little bit, like with the grab by the ghoulies gag in the Nuts
yeah,
and Bolts. But
in that game, they do make in Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts. Yeah, they do make fun of themselves a lot.
I don't know how much room there is for self-deprecation in Kinect Sports 2. Or
no,
whatever.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, unless they're like, "Yep, we're doing it again."
So where are you on Rare, John? What were your thoughts on it? You've got Banjo-Kazooie in your list, haven't you? I mean,
because he doesn't understand what a good game is, and Miss Tui.
This came up on an episode of Radio Trivia. I won't say how recent or not for fear of spoiling something, but the issue of Banjo Tui came up on the Radio Trivia podcast edition with TYP. I enjoyed Tui quite a lot.
I did too, but I would never go back and play it again.
I just did.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't remember if I played it or not.
If you don't get excited about the thought of transforming into an EMT's van so you could sneak into a theme park, you are not a human being.
You know, I think one thing that I felt with Tui is there's a bit of overreach in terms of, yeah, the worlds were probably
huge.
A bit too big.
Oh, they're gigantic.
And the N64 is really struggling with worlds of that scale. And then also, you know, it kind of just brings everything over from the first one and then adds to it with, like, new transformations. You get to play as Mumbo, the Witch Doctor. And
yeah.
You get to split up and you get to new moves. It's just like there's so much stuff in the game. I mean, certainly I think for someone who was coming to it without playing the first one, I don't know how well that'd go down.
Oh, they added the first person stuff too. The weird Doom style shooters.
That was another thing that got multiplayerized, you know, as that sort of became the paradigm of the whole system.
That game, it's probably one of the system's most ambitious, if you don't count the Zelda games.
It's got a lot of stuff in it. They just jam-packed it.
That was my whole point, like going to the well one too many times. They just kind of, you know, it just seemed their approach was...
Maybe they did.
Just stuff more into it, and here, have the same formula with just more.
Well, see, I agree with that, but I would apply that to Donkey Kong 64.
Absolutely.
Which came between the two, didn't it? It was actually,
I thought it was after.
No, it came between because I never played Kazooie. Well, I played a friend's copy later, but I played through Donkey Kong 64 first, which is why I enjoyed it because I never played Banjo-Kazooie.
Because you weren't like, this is insane.
Yeah. And then I probably played about half of Kazooie, and then Banjo-Tooie came out. I bought that.
Yeah, because I don't... Does anybody here have 64 on their list? DK64?
No.
No.
No, no.
Okay. Because where that game falls on its face is they said, well, people like collecting jiggies and notes. What if they like collecting thousands of things?
Yeah.
And they sort of lost sight of why those games were fun. They weren't fun for the sake of collecting.
Yeah, they kind of drove their own game mechanics into the ground.
I mean, obviously you're getting into the realms of highly speculative kind of stuff here, but I don't know whether it's so much they lost sight of it or they were just stretched too thin.
Possibly.
I mean, you could look at it as Nintendo going to the Rare well too many times and saying, make this game, make that game, make that game. You make a massive 3D platform like once a year. Like, I mean, they were, yeah, meanwhile, they were, you know, taking their sweet time with just about everything.
Right.
And, you know, they were demanding a lot of Rare. So I don't know whether, you know, sometimes corners in a game design sense got cut and they just said, well, we could put this in and it'll take you a while to collect a bunch of stuff and that'll make up the difference.
I will say that DK64's final boss is one of the best bosses I've ever seen in a game.
Johnny sort of mentioned the final level and the final boss before.
Yeah, he did. Look, just last week. And that final boss is outstanding in how it inspires teamwork.
But the one thing I did think, go back to Kazooie, how that did take on the Mario 64 team. Because it was, I mean, I don't know, Kazooie, you know, is one of the relatively few games that I played that really did take on the Mario 64 template. I mean, I'm sure there were sort of like quite a few of sort of inferior knockoffs.
There were a lot of like PlayStation games that sort of went that direction. But yeah, Kazooie's a straight riff.
Yeah, I mean, that, for me, you know, I wasn't going to get a lot of derivatives here because you're paying a lot of money for these games. I only wanted it if it was meant to be really good. Banjo-Kazooie got good reviews. And of course, I mean, I think what it did is it embraced more the sort of the fact that this was an exploration game and, you know, these little open worlds that you could find stuff in. I mean, with Mario, it was a little awkward because they were still trying to sort of say, well, it's kind of like the old Mario games because, you know, what would happen is you'd go into a world, you'd find a star, and then you get warped out again. Now, sometimes that's because they change the world on different stars, you know, like, so, okay, well, now this character appears or that character appears, all that, but it's pretty cumbersome, to be honest, to have a world where, you know, there's a bunch of stars that could be collected in the same life, but you can't do that because it just warps you out. In Banjo-Kazooie, like, I mean, especially a smaller world, like the first world or something, you could get 9 jiggies in a matter of minutes. You just like, you could just freely explore and rack them all up without coming in, going back out, coming back in. You know, it just, for me, feels like they took that unencumbered by wanting to seem more like a Mario game. They just took it completely in that exploration direction and did a pretty good job with it.
And that's sort of what necessitated the worlds being so big because they had to spread the jiggies out. Otherwise, you'd have like 6 stacked on top of each other.
Yeah, they did get, I mean, yeah, 2E, they got way bigger. But even in the original, they did get, you know, some of the latter ones did get, and then you had like, was it the forest that actually had the 4 different seasons? You could go into it in different states. That was a bit more like Mario 64. But I think Rare, to be fair to them, I could see, you know, maybe the graphics and all that, you know, was a bit more presentation of the substance in certain cases, although there's one important exception to that I'll get to in my list. But I honestly think they did a really good job with what was asked of them, which was an awful lot.
Oh, yeah.
But James, any others from your list that you want to particularly highlight before we move on?
Yeah, so I'll touch on some of the weird ones I've got on my list. The Ken Griffey Jr. game I mentioned, there was also a Ken Griffey Jr. Slugfest, which I think came out the same year, same calendar year. But
is that a fighter?
No, I think it's like Home Run Derby stuff.
Okay.
It's the only game I played a complete 162 game season in. 9 innings, which takes forever, if you can imagine.
Good lord.
But I also went undefeated and beat many opponents by like 15-1 by the end of the season because I realized I realized how to game the trading system. So I had like every major star of the late 90s on my roster. And also if you have Ken Griffey Jr. in a game with Ken Griffey Jr.'s name on it, you're pretty much guaranteed a home run every at bat. Mission Impossible, which I mentioned, isn't a good game. Just start off.
That got good reviews at the time.
It's okay. But what's interesting about that game is it's kind of a different take on what Bond's single player did. As opposed to just shooting the crap out of everybody you see, you really have to be stealthy. You have to, like, if you're putting listening devices, you really have to not be seen and just kind of blend in. And so I would give this to people who played the Bond game and really liked it and wanted something else like it. But Perfect Dark hadn't come out yet. And I would say, this isn't going to play the same. Don't just start fucking shooting people. And which they would immediately proceed to do and lose.
And it's notable for being, you know, a movie license game of the Tom Cruise, Brian De Palma original Mission Impossible movie, but it doesn't have Tom Cruise's likeness.
Nope.
In a very weird...
It does not. What is interesting about the game, though, is, like I mentioned, it's not based on do you survive more often. It's based on were you seen. It's like real spy stuff versus shooty, shooty death spy.
And is it very objective-based?
Yeah, highly objective-based. So there's a scene where you're in an embassy, and you have to plant these gas emitters on all the air conditioner ducts. But they're not all in easy places to get to, and there's an embassy party going on. So you have to avoid suspicion, but you have to get to parts of the embassy that are closed, but that means not shooting everybody. It's a really difficult game in that respect, and I kind of liked it.
So what makes it a bad game? You said it was a bad game.
It's not a bad game. It's just not a really good game. It's rough around the edges, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just really hairy. Like, they didn't quite get how to do this yet in a game, but it's still kind of this weird fun about it. And there are a few points where you get to just start blasting people. Mega Man 64 is just Mega Man Legends for the PlayStation. I love that game. I didn't have a PlayStation, so this is how I first experienced it. Deal with it. And then Harvest Moon 64 is just Harvest Moon for the Super Nintendo, but I didn't have that, so I played that game. Again, deal with it. Same for Ready to Rumble, only that's Dreamcast, not PlayStation. And then Gauntlet Legends. Gauntlet Legends is this really, really terrible single-player game, because you will die all the time. But it's an arcade port of a Quarter Muncher, but as a multiplayer experience with lots of people where you can level up your dungeon-crawling person, it's actually really fun. Like, just getting four people around the screen trying to kill stuff can be really exciting. And it doesn't have to do split screen, because everybody has to stay on the same screen together. And there's these big bosses and these deep dungeons. It's a huge, expansive game. And you can advance the story when your friends aren't around by playing single player. And then they can pick up where they left off. And it's just a fun multiplayer experience that I know has kind of a cult following, but isn't a big game.
Yeah, it's also, I'm overly familiar with it. It sounds fun. Like another different kind of multiplayer experience.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the old Gauntlet games, really. Like the NES Gauntlet. Only now it's four players with 3D models, and there's blood demons and shit blowing up and magic, and it's crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of from an overhead perspective, right?
Yep. I mean, it's a direct port of the arcade game that came out a bit before it, that you could actually save your profile on the arcade game, come back, put in your initials, and put in a three-digit code, and it'll pick up where your character left off.
Yeah, I remember this.
Or you put in, like, egg, and 999 is your password, and you get to be a chicken. But did anybody else touch on Pokemon Snap?
No, I didn't know. I mean, it's something that's come up a number of times in, you know, when people talk about N64, it does actually come up perhaps more than you might think for a spin-off title, but I've never played it. Has anyone else?
No. I have not. Nope.
It's awesome. Like it's just something kind of relaxing about the game where you're not really in control. You're just sort of going along, and you get to interact with this environment. Like, you see a bush rustle, but you don't know what to do to make whatever's in there come out. You come back later with new items you can throw in there and make stuff come out, and you just see this whole world kind of interact around you. You know, you can't lead a Pikachu to a surfboard, but once he gets there, he starts surfing. I mean, there's just all these wonderful hidden little Easter eggs, and if you were a fan of the Pokemon franchise, you got to see it like the trainers see it. You got to see Pokemon in the wild, which isn't something that you could see in any of the Game Boy games, because they just attacked you like vicious animals.
It's worth mentioning that this, of course, Pokemon Snap is on the Virtual Console, unlike a lot of the games that we've talked about here, especially some of the less obvious ones, anything rare or that kind of stuff. I mean, that's the sad thing, is that, you know, there's a lot, for all the talk about the N64 didn't have that many games or that many that were worth playing, certainly it didn't. I think in America, it probably had about half or less than half as many games to buy, you know, in total as the Super Nintendo did.
Worldwide, they're about...
Worldwide, it was under 400. So, I mean, it did have a small library, but at the same time, it's still...
about 50 were Shogi.
It's still a ton of games that for the system that I would like to play that, you know, I've had difficulty. I mean, one example, I kind of gave up on it showing up on the Virtual Console and found a copy for decent price and all that. It's Excitebike 64 by Left Field. That might come up on a future new business segment once I actually get around to it, because I always heard wonderful things about that, but and you see seems like it could be on the Virtual Console, but it isn't. And that's a sort of, call anything third party is pretty much out of bounds. So that's the sad commentary about this. That some of the reason why we're kind of doing this in some ways is because it's very much more difficult for people to experience the N64 software library now, you know, because it's just the availability is so limited. But, TYP, it's time to move on to your 15.
Sure. Well, we already talked about several of these, and I definitely was a Nintendo fanboy at the time. But here's my list. Star Fox 64, which we've talked about plenty recently.
Lylat Wars.
Lylat Wars, yes.
It's the dumbest rename ever.
Yeah, terrible.
Mario Tennis. Super Smash Brothers. Pilot Wing 64. Mario Golf. Super Mario 64, of course.
We have a trend.
GoldenEye 007. Mario Party 2. Mario Kart 64. Ocarina of Time. Majora's Mask. Kirby 64. Quest 64.
Oh! Get out!
I knew James was going to love that.
Oh, this God. Is like... Johnny arranged this.
No way. Where's the camera?
I will discuss why I put Quest 64 on this list. Sin and Punishment, which is sort of almost retrospectively, because I played it for Wii on the Virtual Console.
Yeah.
And Rayman 2. Although, actually, I'm more familiar with the Dreamcast version.
I played Rayman 2, and I can vouch on the N64, it was a great game. On the 3DS, screw you, Ubisoft.
Oh, yeah. Well, they've recycled that game way too many times.
11 ports. That's the count.
But it is a good game. It does not deserve 11 ports, but it is a good game. It was a linear-style platformer in 3D before Nintendo really showed anyone how to make that work. I mean, Sonic, I enjoy Sonic. Sonic Adventure, I actually like more than probably most people that aren't crazy, rabid Sonic fans.
Weren't at that E3 event.
Yes, at that E3 event. Not that all Sonic fans are rabid, but it was just a really good game. I mean, it really didn't borrow very much from Mario 64. So, I mean, it just sort of stood out as, hey, this is a fun game. So I do have to address Quest 64 because I know it is not a very good game.
Okay, just so we have that.
This is, I think, most famous to people who are not familiar with it at all, other than this fact that it was the first RPG of any sort to come out for the system in America.
Correct. And it was actually, I think, to be honest, my first RPG. I was thinking about this, and I previous podcast, I'd said that Super Mario RPG was my first RPG, but actually, I don't think that's true. I played Quest 64 at a friend's house and then borrowed it for a while. And although, yeah, you're right, it isn't really good, but all this stuff was new to me. So, you know, the concept of turn-based...
So you're telling me that Quest 64 was your first RPG?
Yes, I beat that damn game.
And you played other RPGs, is what you're telling me.
Actually, I kind of like the battle system. I do like the battle system of that game.
I wish I could travel back in time and guide you properly. I really wish I could.
I like the battle. It's pretty simplistic, but the idea that you have an area you can run into, choose what you want to do, and then attack from that position, and that affects your position for the next move. I like that. I think that's actually a nice mechanic. Now, the level design, things went on and on and on in terms of those caves.
But I suppose you wouldn't have known any better, right?
But, you know, it was just a unique game. It was the first game I saw that had like random battles. It was just totally different from anything else I had played. That's the only way I could put it. I mean, it was my first RPG, so I felt it was worth putting on here.
As I mentioned during E3, maybe I mentioned it in the car as we circled around LAX for some amount of time. I beat that game as a child by using the Game Shark to give myself max levels in every stat because I got so tired of going through halfway through a level and getting punked by some random enemy that I was like, you know what? No more of this crap.
Yeah, there was that blue cave in particular, I recall being... That was the hard part. Once I got past that blue cave, things were okay again.
That is the point where the Game Shark came out. And at that point, it was all over because I would walk up to them and be like, no, you die. And they just drop dead. And I was like, this is so much better.
It actually has pretty good music, too. So, I don't know. I don't hate on Quest 64. You know, I guess I have a unique perspective on it.
To be fair, my first N64 RPG was Deion Chronicle, so we're not going to delve into my past.
Jesus.
I blame Nintendo Power.
It was a tough console to start playing RPGs on. I can tell you that, because there really were none, and the ones that were there were just garbage.
Paper Mario was okay, but I didn't put it on my list.
But that was very late.
Yeah.
Let's see. I guess other things I want to touch on. I actually revisited Mario Tennis and Mario Golf in preparation for this podcast last night, and I immediately had fun when I picked those up. I mean, even though Mario Tennis really is a multiplayer game, it's actually a lot of fun to play against the computer. It just sort of has personality. It's very punchy. It's sort of that middle ground between Smash Brothers and some of the other sports games that John was talking about.
Yeah.
It's like a fighting game, but it's a sport game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it's just so fast paced and it's so back and forth that it really feels like a action packed fighting game.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of like, I think they did make it really quite difficult to hit the ball out in Mario Tennis 64. And so that kind of funneled the action into these, you know, rapid fire rallies. You know, it wasn't a case like, you know, in some tennis games, they're more realistic. You'd be worried about, you know, if you was really going to bash it as hard as you can, you'll hit it out of bounds and you lose the point, and that, you know, and it'll sort of be very stop start like that. But you actually, with this, the way they streamlined it down, I mean, you could argue maybe they took some of the skill out of it, but, you know, it did create this sort of, like you said, very punchy kind of action.
But you still have to choose where you're, you know, where you're shooting, whether you're doing long or short. Really, the goal is to, like in real tennis, place the ball someplace that's hard for your opponent to reach.
And you got what, slice, top spin, and smash. I mean, there's still a certain amount of different strokes.
Does that game make it to the virtual console?
Yeah. Yeah, you can buy that.
I played the hell out of the two Camelot, golf and tennis on N64.
Mario Golf is awesome. I mean,
it's a great game.
I like the earlier course designs, but the last one just is brilliant. Every level, every hole, I should say, is themed after a character or a set of characters. It's like a vignette.
Yeah, they're actually made out of the course features. So you'll have a face made out of bunkers and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the ring shot mode is just a whole lot of fun. It is totally different.
Yeah, that is good.
So there's just a lot of fun. Good music, you know, good pacing. You can save any time. And those are both really well-made games.
Mm-hmm.
And I like their sequels, but there's something about the originals that just have a lot of charm. There wasn't, it's sort of like what we were talking about, I guess, with Rare, where they dipped it one too many times. There's kind of like kind of that going on there for the Camelot sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the sequels as well, but I know what you mean. I mean, the originals, I think, were so good. I don't know if there was necessarily that much room for improvement. So some of the things that come in are, you know, maybe a bit the frippery kind of things. But they were really excellent. Is there anything else on your list before I move on to mine?
Well, Pilot Wings. I mean, I don't. It isn't a game that would jump out as me as one of my favorite N64 games at first thought, but I did put a lot of time into it. I really enjoyed exploring some of the nooks and crannies, especially of the little United States areas.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of just crazy little stuff. Like, you can land the gyrocopter or your rocket belt on a gas station and refuel. I mean, there's just lots of weird little things in that game.
It's got a lot more quirkiness to it than I had envisioned.
Yeah.
When, you know, it's like, oh, the Dream Team's got this flight simulator company in it, and it's making the next Pilot Wings. And the Super Nintendo Pilot Wings is not brimming with personality.
No, it's a pretty generic flying game.
It's very tech demo. So there was a lot of things about Pilot Wings when I did get to play it at launch. I got it sometime after of Christmas that year in '96, but it really surprised me just how much quirkiness there was, and you know, the fact that they managed to inject a certain amount of fun into, you know, just exploring these spaces. You obviously had the challenges where you're trying to go through certain hoops and then land correctly on the bullseye and all, you know, the standard kind of stuff. But you know, they had like weird stuff, like, do you remember the jumping boots?
Oh, the jumble hopper, yes.
Yeah, I mean, like, all sorts of crazy stuff. So, you know, that was a pleasant surprise in some ways. You know, I mean, I had it because it got good reviews and because it wasn't anything else to buy. But, you know, I mean, it did actually satisfy me in ways I hadn't expected.
And I also got to put a plug for Mario Party 2. I put 2 down because I felt like the original was, although really innovative,
it was a health hazard.
The hand destroyer.
Yeah, the hand destroyer. So Mario Party 2 still
I'm
felt,
a survivor.
Yeah, Mario Party 2 felt really fresh still. It improved some of the board game mechanics, I think, and it still had some of my favorite mini games. Like Bumper Balls is like one of my favorite mini games from the entire series.
And actually, in two, they realized 3-versus-1 games were actually a lot of fun and greatly underdone in the original game.
Well, I'll move on to my list now, and as you might expect, it's got a lot of ones that we've already heard. But Ocarina of Time, of course, Super Mario 64, Majora's Mask, Smash Brothers, F-Zero X, Star Fox 64. I had GoldenEye and Perfect Dark as a twofer in the spirit of the DKC/DKC2 cop-out in the Super Nintendo 20, and for that matter, the Super Mario World plus All-Stars cop-out. Jet Force Gemini as well, I had that in there. I mean, I share some of James' sentiments about that, but still a favourite. Banjo-Kazooie had the original, just because I felt like it was a bit more streamlined than the sequel. Blast Corps is also a rare game that I had that I'm very great fondness for that I think I'm going to discuss. But just to round out the list, I've then got the 5 non-Nintendo or Rare developed games I picked. 3 of which, you might guess, come from Treasure. So that's Mischief Makers,
yep,
Sin and Punishment, and Bangaio. So, I mean, you know, they've all been covered on the show since I acquired Mischief Makers and Bangaio quite recently, and just talked about them in New Business and stuff, but that it became sort of Treasure's home for a little while after the Saturn went tits up. It was time to find another sort of weird console hardware to work on, and the N64 was it, and those I really like all 3 of those games. They're very good, but they're also, I have to sort of speak up for the European section of the population with International Superstar Soccer 64, which is essentially the predecessor to the modern Pro Evo games. So it was sort of less arcadey than the Super Nintendo one because it was, you know, in 3D with polygonal graphics and stuff. It was more realistic, but it was really, really good for its time, with the realism of the gameplay, with like some of the sophistication in terms of formations and playing through balls, and like it just played a really good game of football. And then finally, I've got an acclaimed game that is not Turok, but it's Shadow Man, which is another sort of comic license thing, although I think it was pretty tenuously linked to the actual comic book. But I'll start in terms of some of the featured games here with Shadow Man, because it's an interesting one. It was a claim to be this sort of pillar of the platform that they were, for better or worse, doing a bit of a Rare thing in terms of they were really cribbing from the big Nintendo games to sort of make this thing in a number of ways. But first of all, it was after Ocarina of Time, and it featured, you know, basically Zed targeting. But, you know, obviously this, you know, the combat was somewhat different. You were this sort of weird voodoo using character, but like he changed between his normal form and then his more spiritual form and stuff. So it was a bit of a dual element to the gameplay there, but you use guns and then this kind of stuff. So it was different from Zelda, but clearly
it was really dark too.
That
rated M.
No, but it wasn't just that it was rated M, to be fair. I mean, like, yeah, Turok's rated M, but it's, you know, a lot of it's kind of silly, gore for gore's sake, pretty puerile stuff. In this case, the subject matter is simply very dark. I mean, it revolves around principally serial killers. They are your antagonists in the game, you know, and they're based on sort of serial killer archetypes. One of them is like the reincarnation of Jack the Ripper, but, you know, another is very much like your Lecter type, and another is like Buffalo Bill from the same movie. You know, and you've got these really sort of appalling settings in the game. Like, one is, I think, in the midst of like a prison break scenarios. There's just like, you know, some sort of prison riots, just dead people everywhere, and this serial killer has taken over the facility. And there's another that's set on the London Underground, where you're sort of facing down Jet the Ripper, and another that's set in the, you know, in Blade Runner, towards the end when Harrison Ford's going to sort of take out Rutger Hauer, and he's in that staircase that's completely dark and everything. They basically just ripped off that setting and then put the guy from Silence of the Lambs in with the night vision goggles. You know, like, I mean, they're really sort of cutting and pasting bits from movies a bit crudely, but at the same time, it's the sort of stuff you just had not seen, especially on Nintendo platforms, this sort of subject matter. And yeah, I mean, the writing wasn't great, and the voice acting was occasionally laughable, but you know, it was impactful at the time for its presentation. It had some really eerie music and all this kind of stuff. And for atmosphere, it was pretty much on an island on N64, I felt. And then in terms of the gameplay, they had this weird thing because you got this Zelda-style combat sort of lock-on stuff. Then you had, like, basically the progression in the game in many ways was actually a bit Mario 64 because there were, by coincidence, 120 Dark Souls that you could collect that helps you unlock different parts of the world. But it was also, in a way, more Metroid-like, which, of course, never got an N64 iteration. But, you know, there's a lot of re-traversal and going back and forth with different, you know, abilities, or you know, probably a bit more lock-and-key-like than at real Metroid, but you know, so it was this sort of mishmash of elements, and it got incredible reviews at the time. It was hugely acclaimed, pardon the pun, but it was, I at the time, I didn't think it was probably quite that good when I played it, and perhaps it would hold up even less well to scrutiny now, but I still think it's worth highlighting as, you know, a game that was, you know, quite daring and ambitious, and also it was, you know, an effective experience at the time. So other than that, Blast Corps is the other one that I most sort of wanted to highlight, because, you know, we talked about a lot of things that Rare did being derivative, but in fact, you know, this was completely original. Mm-hmm. Straight away, and I felt like I hadn't played anything like it. You've got all these different vehicles that you're having to destroy the environments, essentially, in order to clear the way for this nuclear reactor that's on the back of a lorry that is going to melt down, and they've got to put it into a hole in the ground somewhere. And so you're clearing the way. And I mean, you've got like little like motorbikes that shoot missiles, giant mechs that do dragon punches, dump trucks, bulldozers. I mean, every kind of vehicle that you could possibly imagine. And you know, it's like an action game, it's like a puzzle game, it's like a driving game all at once. You know, I mean, this is kind of going back to the Rare that I think of pre-DKC.
Yeah, right.
Back when they made innovative 8-bit games before they sort of became Nintendo's farm sort of studio. And it was fantastic. And I always wish there was something that would carry on that legacy in some way, or simply just a re-release, because it was so good, especially for an early game. It just had a lot of content. I mean, you know, because you had this whole thing of once you actually sort of beat the reactor part of the game, whatever, you got to like go to different planets where they changed the gravity, and you know, so you were playing these like crazy levels where you're floating all over the place, and you had all the medal challenges. So you know, if you could do it, you know, at a certain time, you get a gold medal or a platinum medal at the highest level, and that those completely changed the way you looked at those levels, you know, in the best possible way, where like, you know, you just did it to clear the way before, but now you're looking at it thinking, you know, how on earth am I going to be able to do this in that time? And then you start to piece it together and get better. And the care that those levels were constructed with is revealed to you. Absolutely outstanding. It is a crime that this is so difficult for people to replay now, because, you know, it's not one of the Rare games that's on XBLA, or it's not on VC or anything right. Like that. It's so good.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see, I haven't seen another game like it, really. Really, I played it a long time ago. Actually, I think it was one of the first games I bought for N64.
Yeah, see, that's it. I came so late to the N64, I basically missed it.
Yeah.
Once I got an N64, I was busy playing catch-up.
This is one of those games that one of my friends always raved about, but for some reason I was never interested in.
It's just, I think it's difficult necessarily to sell people on it instantly, you know, so it hasn't got like a recognizable IP, and it's not like, well, it's like Mario or it's like Zelda or, you know, like a lot of Rare's other games where you could sell it that way.
Yeah, it looked to me more almost like Command & Conquer or something just by looking at the graphics.
Well, I guess, yeah, that kind of viewpoint was kind of like three-quarter-ish and all. I mean, obviously, it was all polygonal and stuff, but yeah, I mean, yeah, it wasn't one of Rare's, like, gorgeous games. It was some of it was because it was early, and also it was just mostly functional, you know, just that you had to destroy these environments and all that kind of stuff. But the N64 is generally considered to be a system that had a small number of groundbreaking and utterly brilliant classic games, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, a deep library of good ones. But this, Blast Corps, I would say, is up there with the very best.
Yeah.
Especially, I think, because it's so different, and yet probably very, very few people have played it at all.
Yeah, it's one of those games that it's just way too hard to obtain nowadays, especially with Rare no longer being, you know, anything near Nintendo. You know, you're really not going to see it unless you get an N64 and get the cartridge.
Well, I think we're going to move into the sort of final stages of this now. So, first of all, I'll open the floor for any. Does anyone have any game that hasn't been brought up that they feel strongly about, either good or bad? The N64's got some pretty bad ones. I being an import gamer, I didn't get into that. But I don't, James, have you got anything in that realm? Something that was just a really heinous sort of crime?
I've made fun of Odin Chronicles in passing, like expecting people to know how bad that game was. But if I could be indulged for a moment to explain why that game...
Yeah, I've got to be honest, it's not something I really... Yeah, I mean, it's stuff like Superman 64, everyone knows about that, that it's terrible, and you know, it's a big joke about it. But Odin Chronicles, it's not something...
So the faces look like oatmeal raisin cookies. The graphics are just... like MS Paint gone haywire. A lot of the character models look a lot like tessellations. I mean, they don't look like people. The very first thing you have to do is you have to find someone in a castle, and the castle is so massive and there is no direction, it will take you at least 50 minutes to get to that person. Then you have to get the hell back out. Oh, and it's just massive amounts of walking from one side of the world to the other where you're constantly attacked by random enemies. And then suddenly the game gets way harder and the combat system way more screwed up and you can't get anywhere and you want to die. That is Odin Chronicles.
You could have played Quest 64, James.
I did play Quest 64. It makes Quest 64 like a masterpiece. It is the biggest disaster I have ever laid eyes on.
All right,
the ugliest game on the system.
You settled your score there, James. So well done.
Not till I get my $70 back if I settle my score.
So, I guess we're just going to finalize this now with a quick go round. You know, it's a controversial sort of console. You know, sort of look back. Yeah, I think with some people with great reverence, other people with sort of great derision. It's quite strange in that way. I just want to see, you know, where, you know, some of you guys come down on it as sort of on a personal level in the end. So, James, you know, where does it rank
the pantheon
list of favorite consoles?
It's weird because I have a lot of really great memories of the system, but it's hard for me to see the system without seeing the delays, the wind. I mean, I came to the system late and had a whole year of catch-up time. But I still remember the end days, which felt like the end days because there was nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you would sit there for 2 months and go, "Ah, I wonder where the next game is." And you'd look at the release date online and go, "Yeah, it's not going to be that. I don't know when the release date's going to be, but it's not going to be that date." And you just knew that, A, they were going to miss that date, and B, it just meant another month of waiting. And to me, when Nintendo moved all those games to GameCube, that was almost soul-crushing. Because it was like, the system is dead, and I've been waiting for all this time. And Nintendo could have told me half a year ago it was dead. And I would have been, okay, it's dead.
Yeah, I mean, it got out of the gate pretty nicely. Certainly Zelda, a couple of years later, was a big boost. But seemingly once that waned...
Right.
It started to really limp to the finish line.
We got some games in Death Watch time, but they were so spread out, and the release dates were so erratic. It was like, it'll be sometime in the next 6 months.
Yeah, well, we still get that.
Yeah, well, to some extent, but the difference between then and now is that Nintendo, as we saw, you know, what we talked about at the beginning, with just the announcement of the console, they were of a mindset that they had to talk about things as soon as possible. Say, "Oh, this is coming out, this is coming out, this is coming out. You know, it's going to be okay because all this stuff is coming out." And the problem is, they was talking about it way, way before it would ever actually come out. You know, and obviously, you know, there was a certain amount of things that never really did. You know, including like the 64DD in America. I mean, it did come out in Japan through mail order, but you know, it's important to recognize something like the 64DD, it was not the Sega CD, it was not the 32X, from the point of view that they had planned this from, you know, early on, before the system had even launched. It was like, we're going to do Zelda, it's going to be on the disk drive. You know, this was, it's seemingly like an integral part of their plan, and maybe sort of a mitigating factor against the problems with cartridges, and yet that never materialized, really. I mean, it did so in such a aborted, you know, form, that it was pretty much just like checking the box of like, well, we did actually launch it, sort of, at the end. So, I mean, this was a time when Nintendo just totally contrary to now, where they're very guarded in general. They won't talk about things until they're very close to launch in many cases. They wanted to talk about everything.
Right. And to that point, I remember back in that era, Game Informer, when they did previews, they used to put a percentage of how complete the game was.
Yeah.
So I remember DK64 was 40% complete and it had a release date. I'm like, how the hell can you know when that game's going to come out when it's 40% complete?
Yeah.
How do you know it's 40% complete?
Exactly. Well, I mean, yeah.
You can ask the developer and kind of get a feel for it. But if the developer tells you, yeah, we're not even halfway done, there's no way they know how far out the game's coming out. I mean, they just can't know. Unless they put out a date that's completely insane.
Yeah, it was just a sort of done thing. Isn't that something that comes from Japan? I think the Japanese gaming media was keen on doing that, and I think it's sort of a convention.
Yeah, I don't know, but it always struck, like, Jet Force Gemini, I remember, was another one. It was at, like, 30% and it had a date. I'm like, no, I think doesn't even make sense. It's like,
I wonder how they adjusted the percentages when they like changed the character designs and made them a bit more older looking.
let's put it back 5%, guys. 15% now.
I mean, John, to the point of, you know, where it ranks for you, I mean, you got a PlayStation. I never did, you know. And to be honest, I didn't much want to. I didn't care about RPGs. All the stuff that I would have cared about on PlayStation was the kind of stuff I would have had to import a PlayStation for, and that was way too cost prohibitive. You know, if I wanted to play stuff like Thunder Force 5, I wasn't going to do it on my PAL PlayStation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a non-starter for me. But you had one, mm-hmm. and did that sort of make it okay that the N64 was the way it was? Or, I mean, how did you feel about it?
Well, when I think of the N64, I think of two things. I think it marked a shift for Nintendo themselves. They kind of went off on their own little direction. They went off in their own direction, which has continued right on through to the Wii, really.
Yeah, it's weird though, because I mean, on the one hand, that individual streak has continued, but on the other hand, like, I really feel like this, in some ways it was necessary because they had to, you know, make some of these groundbreaking innovations, but at the same time, I mean, they've really lost their way. You know, this preoccupation with Silicon Graphics and all this stuff, you know, and they got away from the games that people loved the most from them in the NES era, which is the classic instant style of games. You know, I mean, apart from the multiplayer stuff, you know, I mean, stuff like Mario 64, but just think about how many moves he's got in that game.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, I don't think you can really say they got away from giving people the games that they wanted, because there's by far, like, some of the best games that Nintendo ever made came about on the N64.
At a rate that we've never seen them produce before or again, really.
Yeah, just total classics, you know, ready for the time. But at the same time, I do feel like they got so caught up in making games that were important or groundbreaking that it took them a while, I think, to get their groove back in terms of just making games that didn't have to be terribly consequential. They could just be, you know, fun and instantly accessible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they've certainly come back to that. But I mean, for me personally, it was kind of like Nintendo stopped being a one-stop shop for me. Like, I was kind of forced to go elsewhere and have multiple consoles. That's when the whole multiple console thing started for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was the same for a lot of people, especially if they were getting an age at that time when they had more disposable income and could afford to do it. I think that was a big factor as well. And you know, I mean, the thing is, the N64 did pretty well in the States in the sense that it sold 20 million units, but I imagine it did much less well in software from the point of view that people, you know, probably kept it around, kept buying the big Nintendo games or maybe Rare games, but, you know, maybe their bread and butter was on the cheaper PlayStation market.
Yeah.
So I think in hardware, it probably, you know, was relatively a better performer than it was in software, which, you know, I guess is okay for Nintendo because they make a profit on all of that. But of course, it presents big problems, you know, for everything else and sort of the variety of stuff on the platform. I mean, for me, the lack of RPGs wasn't a big deal, but there were genres that, you know, were parts of staples of my gaming diet in the 60-bit era, the big strategy became completely lost to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it became blatantly clear that Nintendo just did not care about certain game genres.
Well, it's like one-on-one fighting games, you know, had passed their peak, you know, and I wasn't that crazy about those on the 60-bit, but whereas you still had, you know, the Street Fighter Alphas and the Darkstalkers and all that kind of stuff on Saturn and PlayStation, you didn't get dick on the N64.
Yeah, no, you didn't.
I mean, you got Killer Instinct Gold, you got Ultimate Mortal Kombat Trilogy 64, whatever, you know, but
Super Edition.
You did not get that sort of quality there. And also, scrolling shooters. That scene endured in Japan. You had stuff like R-Type Delta, you had stuff like Gradius Gaiden, you know, and Thunder Force 5 and G-Darius and all those series. They kept going.
Right.
But if you were on the N64...
Not for Nintendo. And the brawler scene actually went... too, because even on the SNES, there were still brawlers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Saturn had Guardian Heroes, which was, you know, really well regarded, and, you know, it just, like, these all, like, a lot of the ones that were more arcade style, Japanese, in particular, Japanese arcade sort of derived games, seemed to just disappear from Nintendo consoles altogether. And so, on the one hand, there were some things about, you know, being, it was like, well, RPGs, that doesn't affect me. And I still don't think I would enjoy the RPGs of that era, even now. After I've gained more of an appreciation for the genre in general, I don't think those PS1 era ones are for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the other stuff, in retrospect, I think, yeah, you know, I missed out.
Yeah. Oh, you did.
There is a real ambivalence about my feelings about the N64. I mean, tremendous memories. Unbelievable mm-hmm. memories. The anticipation before the system, the multiplayer sessions, Zelda and Mario, just complete earthquake force of when you first played those jaw-dropping stuff. Like I said, it'll never be replicated, and that's as much to do with me and the timing as anything else, obviously. But on the other hand, it was flawed. It was a lot of stupidity going on.
Yeah.
The software library was narrow and all this. It's, I think ultimately it's a kind of system that you love more than you like. Because it is about that sort of personal attachment rather than how robustly it sort of serviced your gaming needs.
Yeah, like it was really good for certain genres of games, really, really bad for others.
Well, I guess I'm closer to Greg and my thoughts, but my gaming habits, especially in the Super Nintendo and 64 era, really were to play the big Nintendo titles, and I would go back and replay old ones I liked. I wouldn't say I had a small library of Super Nintendo games, but I generally played, you know, Mario World over again. And for me, it wasn't a big deal not to have that many big games coming out because I was just fine with playing the games I had for months at a time. And maybe I was trained by Nintendo to do that to some extent.
Well, no, I mean, that was true for me to a pretty big extent as well in terms of being an import gamer had conditioned me to that, you know. And I think in many ways, a lot of people, when it came to the N64 era, their experience sort of came closer to what mine was during the Super Famicom era.
Yeah, I mean, I think even from a young age, for me, I had a great appreciation for, I guess, retro gaming, as we would call it now. I mean, I went back and played my NES games and Super Nintendo games. So, you know, if there was a lull in my N64 lineup for a while, I just went and played something else I owned, you know? So I don't really have bad feelings about the lineup. There were a lot of really great games on the N64. I did feel the pain maybe that last year when I was online. And,
I don't know how you couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like... Other than that, I like the N64 lineup. I had a lot of fun with Star Fox. I had a lot of fun with Mario Golf. You know, there are a lot of really great games that have staying power. And so, to me, yeah, it's a small lineup. But you know what? Even at a gigantic lineup, I probably wouldn't have played that many more games.
You know what? I do feel similar. It's like, you know, if I just had access to, you know, a few of those treasure games that were on the Saturn or, you know, a few of those beat-em-ups, a few of those shoot-em-ups, this guy, that would have been enough. You know, I mean, even now, you know, I have access to PS1 classics.
Exactly.
Through my PS3. How many of them buy? I've bought some. You know, Symphony of the Night stung like a bitch at the time. That stung. Not Final Fantasy VII. Symphony of the Night stung big time. It is a very few cases, but at the same time, I do feel like those games would have been really important to me. If I'd had Symphony of the Night at the time, I probably would have lost my, you know, shit over it or whatever. Yeah. Whereas, you know, it was nice to play it now, but it's, you know, I do feel like I was kind of robbed of that experience that would have been similarly sort of special as stuff like Ocarina was.
Yeah.
So it's limited in scope, perhaps, what I would have wanted more out of it, but nonetheless important to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it holds a much stronger place in my heart than the Wii, and Wii has a more robust lineup. It does, but there are fewer games that I have really fond memories of playing. And maybe that's a function of me being older and less into video games. It probably largely is. and some of it's in a different direction that Nintendo's taken with some of their titles that I don't appeal as much to me, but there's just something about the N64 titles that I think they just have staying power.
Well, John pointed out, though, that there's more groundbreakers on the N64, too. I mean, there are a lot of first of breeds on the N64 where it was kind of magical, because like, I've never seen this before.
Well, I think that is going to do it for our N64 discussion. I'm not going to pretend that it wasn't hugely self-indulgent for us to do this.
Take that, Mets.
Now we could move past this. We need never complain about it again. We could just say, what's 175 episodes between friends? And leave it at that. So I hope you've enjoyed our discussion of the N64 and all its checkered history and the great highs and great lows. But we will move on next week to probably listener mail. So once again, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com if you want to send in your questions, comments, suggestions, responses to this feature, or any of
and
news
nothing
going
to
on
do with downloadable software on smartphones.
Well, we could talk about iOS. I mean, you know,
shut up, John.
iPhone 4S just came out, didn't it?
In your sleep, Lindemann.
I think there is a crosstalk podcast for the new iPhone. So
Radio Phone Nintendo, maybe? We could start calling it RPN?
Shut up. Look, old man, I can make it look natural.
We also we have the retroactive that has begun now, number 20 for River City Ransom for the NES. It's on Virtual Console. The discussion has started in the forums. We've already got quite a few extensive posts. I think people have been a bit less sort of cautious about jumping in with both feet on this compared to Killer 7. So we've got a good discussion ongoing there already. So
what
I would invite you to join in and start talking about it. And then I'm not sure necessarily that we'll get to it next week, but it will be on an episode upcoming shortly, so we may well be drawing on that thread there for comments, and we'll be playing through it ourselves, of course, so I'm quite looking forward to that. And now, before we go, we should also mention, of course, we have the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition here, and we've been coming up on episode 100 for quite a while, so would you update us on where we stand with that?
Well, we recorded a few nights ago, Johnny, Neil, and Zach. So we have a kind of a Jeopardy trivia setup going on there. We've selected 8 games from the last 50 episodes of Radio Trivia, since this is episode 100. And it was a lot of fun to record. I'm hoping it won't be too arduous a task to edit.
Well, I will say for the listeners here that I'm very bitterly disappointed that we couldn't make it work so that I could record that, because I had great fun recording a sort of similar episode back when, before you were leaving for Japan,
right,
in 2008, which was episode 38. I would have loved to do it again, but with just the scheduling, it was too difficult. But I were very, very eager to hear episode 100, of course. And it's worth mentioning that back from 2008 also, you did a Nintendo 64 special episode.
That's right.
Of Radio Trivia. So I think it is simply called the Nintendo 64 special. So if
it's convergence,
the listeners want to go back and listen to that, completely dominated by N64 games. The N64 probably had the widest range of musical quality due to the fact that it didn't have a sound processor. So
yeah.
I think, as I recall, it's a pretty interesting journey through the soundscapes.
In some games, quality is not an applicable word.
Check that out. Like I said, it was in 2008.
Right. It's episode 27.
Pretty much synchronous with Johnny's episode with Chris Kohler and Billy and Evan. So again, that's really worth listening to, as much as we make fun of it. Really good episode. Evan, bless his heart, is reeling off third party N64 games like a trooper. Goemon, Castlevania, Winback from Koei, I think, comes up at one point.
It's a good game.
And the DMA designs stuff as well, like Space Station Silicon Valley and the Body Harvest suit. They were also a Dream Team member. Of course, you know them today as Rockstar North, the creators of GTA. So lots more quality third-party N64 discussion back on episode 89. And so I think it'd be a nice companion to this episode, or the other way around. So that is it for this week. Thanks to our guest, TYP. Thanks to James and John, as always. And until next time, have a nice week.
Bye.
Bye.
Later on.